Well, good morning. This is David Wiley. I'm director of the African Studies Center and a professor of sociology, and this is part of our project to record some of the history of international studies and African studies at Michigan State. And we're delighted to have with us this morning George Axon and Nancy Axon, who have been pioneers and have been a part of Michigan State's international efforts since the 1960s, I believe. So why don't we start just by your introducing yourselves as to who you are and where you came from and how you came to Michigan State. Nancy, do you want to start on that?
We were married at Cornell when we were still undergraduates, and as soon as we got done with our degrees, we started working at the Cornell Agricultural Experiment Station in Geneva, New York. We moved every year for so many years to another university that by the time we got to East Lansing in 1953, I didn't change the hems on the curtains I hung in the kitchen because I was sure we would go again. And we've been here ever since.
And that's 50 years ago. Yeah. I won't go through all of the things, but I was at the University of Delaware before I came here. We had a department there called the Department of Rural Communication. It was a two-person department. I was the head. It was the only department of that name in the United States, and that name did not continue anywhere. Michigan State was getting into the television business then, and I was producing television and radio programs at that time for the University of Delaware. And so MSC it was then, invited us. Michigan State College invited us to come here late in 1952. I was teaching though also, and our semesters were on a little different schedule then. I said I couldn't come till the end of the semester, which was in January. So on the first day of February of 1953, we came here in the College of, I was attached to the College of Agriculture and what was then called Home Economics, to produce television programs for them. And one thing led to another after that. I don't know how much detail you want to add here, because it was less than 10 years later when I was, by that time, I was the associate director of the Cooperative Extension Service, and John Hanna was our president, and Glenn Taggart was the new dean of international studies and programs.
So what year was that?
That was in 1952, I guess.
52?
No. In 19, I guess, 60. 59 or 60.
59 or 60.
I think it must have been 60, 1960. And I was walking across the campus with Glenn Taggart on our way to President Hanna's office, and I couldn't remember. I don't remember. Glenn asked me to come, and I wasn't sure what it was. On the way, I was asking him, what is it that the president wants? And he was saying, well, you know, we have this project in Nigeria. We just started. We're supposed to be helping them start a university called the University of Nigeria, mostly funded by Nigerians. And the U.S. government had agreed to help with some technical assistance. President Hanna was very interested in that. He'd been to Nsukka in Nigeria twice by then. We sent a small team of people like we had here, well-meaning academic persons who are absolute amateurs in terms of anything international. But of course the rationale was that that's not good. The whole campus was like that. And what we had to do is somehow convert the faculty to people who have some interest and knowledge about the world outside of Michigan, to say nothing of the United States. Anyway, when I got to President Hanna's office, I got a big lecture about that. And it came down to George, are you ready to go to Nigeria? And to be honest with you, I wasn't sure where Nigeria was. I was like the rest of my colleagues. So I said, well, I ought to think about that. What does it mean in terms of my connection with the institution and whatnot? And they said, no, don't worry about that, but it is a full-time job and it'll take you all the time you got. Of course, we want you to coordinate the project over there, which means going back and forth between Nigeria and the MSU campus and recruiting people here to go there, recruiting people there to come back here and study and whatnot. And they explained in some detail. I won't give you all that now. Anyway, I said, give me a few days to think about it. So I went home. Nancy and I got out the map of Africa. And to be honest with you, I think she put her finger around Ethiopia, and we followed the coast all the way around up the other side. We found Nigeria. And let me just say something about the rationale for it all that relates to that little story. I was not different from our other teaching faculty. There had been a committee on the campus during World War II who was very annoyed by the fact that the Americans were landing troops on beaches where there were coral reefs. Nobody knew there were coral reefs. Our maps were wrong. They had no idea who lived on that island. They were getting killed on the coral reefs before they ever got to the island. And that committee of faculty members, John Eusene was one of the leaders of it. There were others. Well, John Eusene really... Yeah, about that time, in the 50s, the war was over, they had come back here. They were saying, you know, we have not been fair and appropriate academically for our own students at Michigan, then Michigan State College, which is preparing people to live in the world in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 decades. We have to somehow build an international dimension into every course. Whatever it is we teach, what the professor ought to know is how that is reflected globally, not just in USA. I can give you many examples, but oh, no. Anyway, and the result of that was, yes, after a little bit of thought, prayer, etc., we decided, yeah, George is expendable. Send him to Nigeria.
So that was the decision of both of you to go at the same time? Or were you
No, he went. I was at home with children, one who was very, very sick at that time for several years, and believe you me, I was at home.
Uh-huh.
And so he went back and forth. He went back and forth 6 weeks in the United States, 1 week in London, because you haven't said anything about that cooperative organization, then 6 weeks in Nigeria, then back to London, then back to the United States. Yeah. And he did that for about 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Was President Zikwe here at any time? And
He was there most of the time.
He was there, right.
By that time, he was governor general in the
Eastern
region, and he was just becoming president of the country by then, and so he was mostly there, although he was much involved. And he had Homa and Suka on the campus. I should say that one of the early things that President Hanna told me in a very frank discussion was that, you know, the British think that their education is much superior to ours. Anybody in Nigeria who's had an education, a higher education, has had it in England. So the assumption is that this is a second-rate kind of place, and that any school which would teach things like agriculture and home economics and even engineering is obviously not a top-right university. So, George, he said, your job is to go to the University of London, which has agreed to, because it had a committee on colleges overseas and special relations, and it worked with colleges overseas that the British government had many places. I won't go into the details of that unless you want more.
The University of London affiliation with virtually all their colonial universities,
exactly.
Right?
And so my assignment the first time would go to the University of London, meet the people there on their committee on colleges overseas. One dame, Lillian Penson, was in charge of it, and there were others who got involved with us more, and let them educate you a little bit before you go to Nigeria. Then keep on going to Lagos and meet the U.S. It was ICA then. It just then became AID, and learn about how that organization works, and then go to Ansuka and start work and stay there as long as you need to and come back. And as Nancy was saying, I ended up with a routine. It was not exactly a routine, but I'd stay about 6 weeks in Ansuka and in Lagos, going back and forth and whatever business had to be done. Then at least a week in London, then back on campus here for 6 weeks, because we were recruiting people from all over the United States, including from some of the primarily black universities, to go on our team to Nigeria in those days, and people from all different colleges and faculties on this campus. And then we were placing young, promising Nigerians in universities, not only at MSU, but elsewhere in the USA. And we were tracking, and there was a University of Nigeria, a small office, a one-person deal in London. So we were trying to track Nigerians who were doing higher education anywhere in the world so that we could recruit them to Ansuka. So those were the tasks that I was involved in at that time.
I guess it was quite a contrast. My understanding I was at Ibadan in 1961, and I was told then that the largest department at the university was the Department of Classics. And I believe there was no single agriculturalist on the faculty or human ecologist.
Ezekiel had gone to Ibadan because that was the university at that time, University College. And he went to the botany department. And they had a nice greenhouse, so they took him there and showed him. What are they growing there? They're growing all the plants of England. Now, the botany department had a lab. You had to have a lab in your botany department. They brought plant samples, sometimes in formaldehyde bottles, from England, so the students could learn the different things about those plants. And then they took their exams about those plants. And he told me that he looked out the window, and here are these coconut palms and palm oil palms. And he asked the people teaching that, do your students do anything with those? And he said, no, because they have to pass the exam, you see, that's set in London. And therefore, they have to be prepared to pass that exam. Well, I wish that education, both at higher and middle levels, were different from that in the USA today. But that's another thing. Ezekwe said, no, I want to have a university which will help prepare the next generation of Nigerians to do the things that needed to be done in Nigeria. We need engineers, not high-tech engineers who are very specialized, but some, he was the only engineer in the village. Therefore, he should know something about electrical, something about mechanical, something about civil engineering, because if they need a bridge, he's going to be the only engineer. Well, that same sort of approach was applied to all kind of different fields. And he also came over here and said, I don't want a U.S. land-grant university duplicated in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And President Hanna was very strong on that, and they kept repeating, yes, we're going to try to develop a university uniquely appropriate to the needs and interests of the people of Nigeria.
My understanding was that a lot of the money that he invested in the building of that university that came from taxation that he had pushed through in the 50s on palm oil, which was that actually correct?
Yes, he had gone to the USA. I mean, he had some education in the USA, gone back to Nigeria. He came to the USA and he was looking for money for various things, but especially to start a new university. And he was in New York and he saw this building that had the big sign Palm Olive Pete, whatever, that corporation. And he went into there because he knew that palm olive oil was all coming from Nigeria and other such places. And he got to see some official executive and proposed to them, since you're taking all that oil from us and giving us very little back, we would like to have a grant from you to help start this university. Well, they did the usual thing. They were very polite and all that. But zero came out of that. He went back. This time, at that period, he was Governor General of the East. They put through tax legislation then because they were shipping out palm oil of a certain number of then British pounds and shillings per kg of that palm oil would be set aside as a fund to start this new university. So when 1960 came, independence in October of 1960, he designated all that money to build this university. They really had in cash money much more than the Americans or the British could contribute. Enough to start building buildings then. And he actually started building buildings before we had a master plan for the university. But that was Ezekwe and his strategy. And I must say he was quite successful in that, getting the money from. So it was Nigerian money taxed in Nigeria before it was sent out. And, of course, that means the price was higher for the Americans and others. So they unfortunately didn't do the same thing with oil, but that's another story I won't say anything about.
So how long did you continue to work in Nigeria?
I did that for 7 years. The first five I was commuting, as we said, and Nancy had been there twice, I think.
Once
during that, because she did her master's degree in that Nsukka area. Hmm. I mean, she did the field research for it. And the next two, we moved the whole family, Nancy and myself and four little kids, got on a plane and flew to London and then to Nsukka, and we lived there for 2 years. One of them, for her senior year in high school, came back. The other three stayed with us for the whole time. But, as you know, at a certain point, the former eastern region had a big fuss with the rest of Nigeria and seceded. And I don't know whether you want me to go into any details of that. But after the secession, things were a little bit sticky, and the Nigerians declared a blockade of the whole then eastern region. And so things were a little bit raunchy inside. And also our faculty got... There were the riots, as you may recall, in the north. Christians from the south were being slaughtered in the churches, etc. They began migrating back into Enugu. And... some of that in the eastern region, mostly in the north, And our Zikuwe's goal was to set up a university that would be Nigerian. That's why Nsukka was a good place, as far north and west as you could get in the former eastern region. And therefore, and then we had some rules. Like in the dormitories, we didn't have a bunch of Hausa speaking people one place and Igbo speaking and Yoruba speaking in another place. The students were all integrated. And we didn't. You want me to talk longer or
slower?
Thank you.
So the strategy was
we didn't have separate eating. The food at the cafeteria was a real challenge, and there was a variety of foods available, but all students got on the same line and went through that line, and even when we later brought some Peace Corps volunteers, they went through the same line.
And the students there was unhappy with the dorm food, just like the students everywhere else in the world
yeah.
are.
But the strategy was, it was one Nigeria. We were trying to work mm-hmm. toward one Nigeria, not mm-hmm. a separate set of things. And so all their living. But when the blockade started, you see, and the slaughtering began, students from the north and faculty from the north started leaving, and same with those from the west. And by July of 1967, we were still giving exams there. It must have been in May that they evacuated the Rana children. Do you want to tell about that, Nancy?
I could, I guess, but I don't know how much you want of that. We had 30 Michigan State team members there then, and with their families. Now, most of them by then were, or the majority, I think, were probably actually Michigan State people. I haven't counted that up. But our experience with bringing student faculty members from the black colleges didn't work as well as we had anticipated that it might. And so increasingly we got more involved with the people right here on the campus. So we had 30 families, and for the last month or two that we were on the campus, we had a clandestine, it says here, shortwave radio in our bedroom under a box.
Yes, this was installed by the U.S. government because they were concerned about us there in this sort of isolated place as the turbulence was going.
And the reason I'm laughing about it being clandestine was because they had a wire that they strung out from our house to Bob Dean's house, which was next door. But, of course, everybody on the campus was aware that it was there.
This was a red air wire with a black thing coming down the middle and going into our bedroom window. And inside there, they had built for us a little cabinet so that I kept it in the cabinet, because the government of Nigeria would not license it in any way. USAID had several of these shortwave, two-way, single sideband radios scattered around the country. And for our part of the eastern region, ours was the only one.
But Nigerian faculty told us later in the years that, of course, they could listen in.
Yeah, because when I was on, it would crowd out their radio. It was relatively powerful. But since we were not licensed, we were on for like 10, 15 minutes a day, and the time changed all the while. And at the end of each thing, they would tell me what time it was going to be tomorrow.
So it was a very tense time, and we all assumed that when the orders came to evacuate, in fact, we had checked out the campus for where the plane would be able to come
where the helicopter could come get us
and this kind of stuff, and we all assumed we would all be going.
Yeah, I should say the U.S. government had appointed me their warden for that corner of Nigeria, which included all the American citizens there, including Peace Corps volunteers who were scattered here and there, and other American
and
missionaries and whatnot. Anyway, so we've come sort of to the end of our story instead of the beginning about the University of Nigeria, but yeah, this was, for me, 7 years after the, not to the day 7 years, but when that evacuation came, and as Nancy was about to tell you, they then sent the instructions to us, take a convoy of cars down to Port Harcourt, and only the women and children. The men should stay there on the campus, pretending that's nothing happening, because they didn't want people to think the U.S. government was worried that there was going to be a fighting war, so therefore stay there and pretend that it's business as usual at the same old stand.
I see. And this was in 1967?
Yes, in May of 1967.
Yeah, Nancy has good notes about that. What I remember while she's looking is that after the women and children gone, then I had a problem of these, a little less than 30 by then, men. We had some short-termers, too. They'd come out for short assignments. We used to have short-term people for 4 to 6 weeks. from the MSU campus, and the families would stay 2 years. 15 families were recruited each year, and 15 went home each year. They were basically two-year terms. One or two stayed beyond that, but mostly didn't. So anyway, we had this group of men and morale amongst them, and they were supposed to keep morale high amongst our Nigerian colleagues.
June 3rd, 1967 was the day that we were...
That's another story of how the women got down there.
Yeah, and I have that all.
And the reason I remember the other one is because on the 4th of July, now the 3rd of July of that year, all the Michigan State staff was gathered across the street from me in Andy Doyle's home, just visiting and knowing, because George is going to be on the radio now. And I checked in with the aide, Lagos it was called, and they were telling me, you know, they think the Northern Army is moving south. They've come below Kaduna. They're heading for Nsukka, we think, but we're not sure how many of they are, when they're going to arrive, and so on. And we don't want you to talk to the Biafran Army about that, because, you know, you're not supposed to be into that kind of thing. But be ready to be evacuated any time. We had been evacuated a couple of times before that on false alarms. And I said to them, well, what time tomorrow should we discuss this? And I said, oh, we're not going to be here tomorrow because it's the 4th of July. The ambassador's having his annual party. We're closed for the day. And I can't tell you on this tape the language I used to raise the question. You're not serious. Then I had the sad task of walking across the street to confront our whole group. Mm. And inform them of what I knew and the fact that tomorrow. But on the 6th of July is when the first shells came through the roof of the Princess Alexandra Auditorium, and that's when we officially evacuated. Most of the staff went down to Enugu then. George and one staff member got on a canoe across the Niger River and went to Lagos to complain to the aid people about how they were mishandling all of this, and that's another series of...
Well, maybe we should go back to talking about what the Reader University was, if that's one of the things you...
Sure. That's right. You were there at the beginning of independence, really, in Nigeria, and...
I was not there on the first day of it. Well, we had sent a small team out there, six people, an administrative officer and five faculty members...
For the independence celebration.
A little after, just right about the time. Oh. Independence was, I think, on October... first, maybe.
Yes.
And they were arriving at that time, and they started in. But they had, you know, there were new buildings, fresh. Just they scraped the soil there and built buildings. So that we had a problem with cobras. Now, we all had a problem with cobras, but they had running water. So you had a shower room, which just had a shower running onto a place in the floor where it fell. And the cobras needed water. So if you didn't have lights on, you walk into your shower room. I'm just picking that as one example. And it's all kind of, you know, these Americans are used to having toilet paper. Well, that could be brought from Enugu and purchased down there. So just supply management for little things like that was it. And they were able to purchase some small Fiat vehicles rather quickly and hire some drivers. And they're beginning things. But, you know, that first group sort of landed... Now, most of them had never been out of the United States before. They had no idea what British education was like compared to American education. They had, you know, they were really, it's like sending the Americans in so many other parts of the world. We send naive, innocent people to get murdered one way or another because we simply didn't bother to study the situation, to have some understanding of it, the background, the culture and the subcultural modalities. It just never occurred to them. You know, and for instance, they walk into a classroom to teach, and the students all stand up. Well, an American professor doesn't know what to do. Do you tell them to sit down? Do you sit down yourself? And all kind of little things and big things, and they were really drowning in the administrative and human aspects, and they really got to curriculum development and work on the session. And that's when... That's what Glenn Taggart and John Hanna said to young, innocent George. Look, you know, you've worked at administration, all these kind of things. Go there and solve these problems. Mm. And also, Hanna pointed out, you know, this relationship with the British, we have to build it and keep it going. Because we're not legitimate in the Nigerian eyes unless the British are our partners. So you convince them this is a legitimate thing and they should be our partners. And that took some years. But anyway, that was... That was the rationale. Mm-hmm. And from the beginning, we couldn't really get to any of that. We were busy drying out the bathrooms and finding paper and so on.
In those early years, was the mood one of excitement in Nigeria about independence, about the possibilities of development, about the future, or were you immediately beset with the ethnic tensions? And
I think one of the very exciting things about that, even in the 65 to 67 when I was there, was the Nigerian faculty who were there. Many of them, of course, had gotten their higher education in the United States and came back, and they were from many different ethnic groups. This very week in the New York Times, there was a four-page section on Nigeria. And who was the Minister of Science and Technology? Turner Esong. Turner Esong was on our faculty in 1960.
He had come to MSU as a participant under that program and been there.
He was not an Easterner. He left at the time of the problems because he was married to an American woman, so I can't keep track of them always. And, I thought the faculty there, Babs Pfaffenhoff, for instance, has been a friend ever since. And
he later became the Minister of Education in Nigeria and helped to start the Association of African Universities. Yes.
And, there was an internal diaspora that was a result of really the war. I mean, we tend to think of the war as a negative thing. You know, the whole thing got shot up, the bombs were dropped. You can destroy buildings easily. But personnel, I think there was only one professor that we lost and one other guy, and very few of the students. But the doctrine of the university continued, which means that even though the next government that came in Lagos did not want the university to be there at all, didn't understand the doctrine and wanted to get rid of it, it's very difficult to change a doctrine, as you can experience as a sociologist. Well, that doctrine persisted even to today, and it was the kind of things that John Hanna and Nnamdi Azikiwe talked about.
And that was, in broad terms?
We're going to focus on the applied needs of the people of Nigeria, and we're going to produce people here who will, through a education which prepares them to go back to their villages and help them move into what they said was the 20th century. And in engineering, in agriculture, in journalism, in vocational education, in home economics, in various fields. Now, they had we had a thing like our general college, general studies college was here at Michigan State, so they all had to go through some basic college level in the social sciences, the natural sciences, literature, etc. But they wanted to, I mean, the whole rationale was that they were going to do things, and they would do things for and on behalf of a different Nigeria. Anyway, I would say that has persisted. And in the early days, back to your question, there were enthusiastic, vigorous, excited people on that faculty. The teacher, mostly male, but not all male, and their families. I mean, they were there to break the path into the future for all of Africa. And they were very excited about that. People like Kalu Wazera and Ben Chukwudebi, who was on the board of directors, Azikiwe himself and the others he had on his board, they were very enthusiastic and excited. They were doing something new and different. And, and they knew that Nigeria was a mixture. I mean, Nigeria was, they blamed it on the British. It wasn't the Nigerians who made that into one country, and even the three districts into one, that was all for British commercial purposes, and they were in charge. So that there was a lot of anti-colonial feeling in a place that had just gotten out of colonialism, mm-hmm. as you could expect. And they saw the University of Nigeria as a means to really escape not only the facade of colonialism, but the underlying cultural and physical and biological and financial things that go with colonialism.
Mm-hmm. Now, did that mean that there were tensions between the Nsukka faculty and the Ibadan faculty, where there were many British Yeah. Expat faculty were still.
Fortunately, you know, we were far away. It was a day long drive to get from one to the other, and not an easy drive at that. And usually we were going to Lagos, we could stop at Ibadan.
Of course, we went to Ibadan because our two older children, the first year we were there, in the international school.
Mm-hmm. And on the Ibadan campus,
and our son stayed there for 2 years. So we went and interacted with various people there, but the Ibadan hadn't learned their way to Ensuka, that's for sure.
Yeah, and you know, and it was a little bit like what we've gone through in many parts of the world, including this one, that when someone tried to start a university which would deal with the working people and make life better for them and help them learn how to apply science to agriculture and to mechanical arts and things like that, those in the older university, which, you know, were basically not professional schools, I mean, they would train teachers and the clergy, and otherwise it was just the education of a human being in the classics. And So Ibadan followed that path, and Ensuka was seen as a bunch of rebels who are going to weaken higher education. To give a degree in these subjects itself means all higher education. Same argument in our legislature here in 1855 on this campus or in this town. And, you know, they already had a professor of agriculture at the University of Michigan, but he didn't do anything.
But George, I think.
But that same battle was there, and it was definitely, there was animosity between the faculty at Ibadan and Ensuka.
We did have unusual faculty from England, from London, that came as part of this kind of triumph that had been organized, and they were usually very senior kinds of people, but trying.
They worked with you at Ensuka on the faculty?
Yes. Uh-huh. We had several of them. I wish I could remember all their names.
So you were recruiting from the university community in Britain to participate?
And we got good help from the from this committee there on colleges overseas and special relation in the recruiting process, because they had to recruit unusual scholars from their own faculty, and there weren't many. They were vastly outnumbered by the Americans. Now, the Dutch government got involved in it too, a thing called NUFIC, the Netherlands Foundation for International Cooperation, or sponsored a small program. They became our partners. Fortunately, they hired to direct the Dutch group there an American gentleman of Dutch descent who had been on our team. So we had good relationships with them, and both their management in the Netherlands and the people that they sent. But again, it was small. I mean, I don't have the numbers in my head, but we had like 30 faculty members from Michigan State, and we had over 100 Nigerian faculty members by the end. And we had maybe 3 British faculty members and maybe 3 or 4 of the Netherlands.
I think maybe 5 Dutch, you know, because they went out with us when we evacuated.
And so in terms of this struggle of two paradigms of education, if you will, between the Ibadan and University of Nigeria, is there anything that came of that by the end of the Michigan State relationship
I mentioned there was this diaspora. I mean, for instance, journalism was not taught as a degree subject anywhere in Africa when we started the School of Journalism. And you could take out the word journalism, put in home economics and 2 or 3 other things. Well, when the fighting started, or just before the fighting started, many of our journalism faculty had come from Lagos, and some from the north, but mostly from the west, and they went to Lagos and insisted that the University of Lagos start a journalism department, because otherwise they're going to be out of a job. And they did. And others from several of our fields went to Malawi, they went to Kenya, they went to Tanzania, they went to other places to join, and all of those places that had universities had the standard British overseas model. And they came as evacuees. We even had them at Bunda College in Malawi from Ensuka because of the war. And they became the seed of, I could say, revolution, but not out loud, and had a great impact. So, and Ibadan was never the same after that. For one thing, you know, you have to take in your brothers from the other places, and And they're coming with different ideas. We have people, we had departments and whole schools or colleges that were different from what had formerly been at any of these British colleges in special relationship with their counterparts in the United Kingdom. And that was like an infectious, you'd say, disease if we were sitting in London talking about that, which in a way contaminated all the others. Mm-hmm. Not so much Ethiopia, because they were already in their own thing, but in other African countries, and especially back to Ibadan and Kaduna. I mean, we were, by that time they started starting other universities in Nigeria, and they pulled beginning faculty from where they could get them, included from Nsukka. Well, those who came from Nsukka were different.
Was there a common exam that civil service took in Nigeria that the students, the graduates of the different universities had to take?
No, we didn't have that.
Nothing of that.
The ones at universities in special relation took common exams from London. But we were free to make our own.
So someone suggested that at some point there was some comparative scores between Nsukka grads and Ibadan scores on some common exams.
Well, for instance, the Shell BP people were there in the oil business at that time, and they were recruiting from all over. And so they could compare performance. And what happened was, you know, we had this general studies program in addition to the engineering, and also our engineering was based on, you don't really get too specialized in one thing. I mean, it's an undergraduate engineering, you get a little bit of every kind of engineering. And what they found at Shell BP is if you hire one of those, you can make him an assistant, a trainee sort of, in any department, and you can rotate him through two or three different departments. If you hire one from Ibadan, he wants to go only to his own kind of department and stay there. So, and they made some analysis of that, which they published. They discovered that the Nsukka graduates are more flexible. They'll go to whatever job you're assigned to. They can move for 3 or 4, and they move up into management. If you get one from what Ife had started by then, too, or from Ibadan, you're getting somebody that has a category. If you don't have the right job for him, he won't even come. And if you hire him in that job, he's not going to move from it. Mm-hmm. Well, they didn't think they could build their corporations. And there was some analysis of that on a broader scale where people were saying, yeah, the Nsukka graduates are more desirable. And of course they published that, which didn't make the other people happy at all. But there wasn't a general exam that you could take and show who did better and who did less. Mm-hmm. For one thing, within the campus, we had different ways of examining from different schools and colleges. And we tried to avoid the multiple guess kind of questions, which were so easy to memorize. Because we didn't change the primary and secondary education all that much, although we had a college of education there. We had John Hansen and others working with the schools. But there was a tendency when they came to Nsukka for a student to discover that, you know, I have to be able to understand the thing and use it, not just fill out forms on paper. And right from the first year, that was one of our emphases. I'll give you one little example in engineering, because we, in a four-year curriculum, we couldn't do it, so we made that 5 years. But the first year was only shop. You know, here in USA, a kid goes to school, he's already taken apart two or three clocks, he knows what a screwdriver is and what a hammer is. Our students would come there with their high school graduation certificates, but they had never touched a tool. So we had a little basic work in carpentry and in metalwork and a variety of stuff like that for the engineering students. And then only they got into further class. I mean, they didn't take physics and chemistry until after they had learned what those things were. And then, we dealt with irrigation, for example. The Dutch were very helpful in that, and water systems. But municipal water systems was an absent phenomenon in Nigeria. I mean, you went to the river if you were lucky enough to have one, or else you dug a well by hand. And that's what it was. And sewage was not a non-existent thing. I mean, control of sewage and cleanliness of water and all those kind of things. So in preparing engineers, and there's similar things in other fields, but from the beginning, the University of Nigeria at Nsukka was focused on the application and the fact that our graduates had to stay in Nigeria and do the things that were needed to bring that country into the 20th century, which they were claiming it wasn't.
I might talk a little about home economics because, of course, it was unknown on the continent at the time there. But and I'm sitting here racking my brain for the Fleming is what I want to say, Kittrell, who was a Nigerian woman who was a friend of or an acquaintance of Zeke's, anyhow, had done her home economics work in the United States, and she came back. And then that was really the basis for starting this kind of concern that we should have that kind of a school. And so they had, we sent an advisor over, and we had two direct hire women, American women, who came. And, of course, that's a pathetic way to start out because you're starting out with a whole different mindset of what's possible and available and all those other kinds, and family life. Now, I had done my research for my master's under B. Pelucci here on the campus on management and family decision-making in polygamous households. So at least I had a little basis for what was the real world of that part of the world. I wasn't a faculty, I wasn't on the staff at all. I was a faculty wife and with kids, including one that was not even a little over a year old. So I did work with that school and teach a couple of classes with some of the Nigerian faculty. And our first goal was to identify a couple of Nigerian women who could then come to the United States and get their degrees and go back and be the core of the faculty, really. And that was Maria Ahunanya, who came here to Michigan State in the years between when I came for do my research there and when I went back to live there. And she came back on the faculty, and a couple of other women from Nigeria came to really build the core of the faculty up in that kind of way. But home economics is one of those fascinating things. If you're going to look at polygamous households in areas where there is no water, no stoves, you're really talking about a whole different world than the world that people in this country had worked with. So it was very fascinating. And the students who came, the women who came, were all starting out from not knowing anything about what we were talking about to becoming really home economists who could then go not only into Nigeria but into other African countries and help that, quote, profession become useful to the women all over the continent.
What were the kind of major topics that you were starting the curriculum on and that were focused?
Well, nutrition, obviously.
Yeah. You know, And in nutrition, you know, the Americans are like everybody else. They have their own set patterns. So here we would have 7 food groups or 5 food groups, and we have charts and all kinds of things to teach from and give those. Well, this Maria Ahunanya that Nancy mentioned, when she started teaching nutrition, she would go into the village where this group of women had a log, and she would put foods on the log. You know, here's some yams, here's some cassava, here's some palm oil. If you had a little meat, there was that. And she made her own food groups based on what they had. Mm-hmm. And then she taught the essence of nutrition based on what their food was. We did the same thing with water quality. You know, those who had best water there were the ones who had a roof of some kind and a barrel under it so the water would drain off the roof and go into the barrel, the rainwater. But what she did is she invited, she and Nancy together, women from a variety of places to come and bring a little bottle of water from their own water supply. It was usually in a jug of some kind or in a barrel. And then she had them, one at a time, lay that in a microscope, I guess.
Yes. We got one of the science faculty to get involved in this, and they all made a slide. And then they looked in the slide at what their water, you know, it looked clean, actually had in it, and it was fascinating. And then when we did that, and they came on the campus on the bus, I invited them to my house Well, they had never seen within a storied house. These are people from the villages. They had never been in a house that had two stories, that had an indoor kitchen with all of that stuff. And they were fascinated by all this. And we served, you know, tea and cookies or something. And then we were sitting around the living room. I've written that, but it isn't here. We were sitting around the living room, and they said to me, "How many children do you have?" Well, I'm a believer in family planning, but I'm not an example of it. And so I was busy explaining that I had four, and they were from, at that age, 15 down to 2, you know, kind of thing. And the woman stopped me, and she said, "You know something we don't know." I'm embarrassed because my family planning is so poor. And she, of course, is striking on those spaces between. "You know something we don't know," she said. "How can you help us?"
Hmm. Yeah, so family planning as well as nutrition and hygiene,
yes,
and the systems of clean water,
yes,
and
yes,
food preservation.
And management, which is a topic that they teach in places like this. But management is different when you're managing a polygynous household. And the Yoruba polygynous household is organized different from the Igbo one, and even the Nsukka Igbo one is different from the Onitsha Igbo one. And so teaching human ecology or home economics there was an example of the kind of things that our faculty and our administration were dedicated to, that we weren't going to take a home economics book from some place and make them memorize it and then give them a written exam on it.
But you had to learn the system as it existed, and then what can you do to help them within that system?
Part of the, in my visit with the President DiBiagio to Nsukka, I was struck that there was a Kellogg Center there, and with the green and white colors, a lot of MSU culture. Does that Kellogg Center there also reflect the existence of an extension system on campus and a commitment to relationship with the villagers and the like?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, it was a continuing education center. I don't think we had the word Kellogg on it any place. But we got the same architect, Gordon Belson, who designed the original Kellogg Center on this campus. And he came out there and spent some time with us, and we got some grant funds from Kellogg, I guess, and maybe some other places to build a building, which was going to be a continuing education center. And the rationale...
CEC.
Yeah, CEC, Continuing Education Center. The rationale for that was the same as what John Hanna had for the building of the one here, because he got a lot of flack that you don't build a hotel in East Lansing. You build it in Detroit. Nobody's ever going to come all the way to East Lansing for a thing like that. But he wanted our faculty to have to face people in the real world and attempt to lecture them, teach them, whatever, because of the impact it would have on the faculty. And he used to use accounting as an example. He said, you know, he sat in the back of the room at Kellogg Center one time. A bunch of accountants were there, and some professor of accounting had given a little bit of a lecture. And one of the guys stands up and says, "You know, that may be true, professor, but, you know, in my business it doesn't work that way. Here's how it works." Well, he wanted the faculty to get that kind of feedback from the professionals in the working field, whatever it was. And with that in mind, we wanted the whole Nsukka. In home economics, it was kind of easy. You could walk away, you know, half an hour, and you're in the middle of a village where people are. Not easy, but what Nancy was telling me, that Maria Hanayan, she had done, that could be done. But in all kind of other fields, they wanted real people to have to come in there for various exercises, and the faculty to have to face them and give their lectures and do their things with professionals in that field. And it was a novel idea, again, resisted by people on our own campus. Nigerians said, "Wait a minute, if you allow somebody on our campus who doesn't have school leaving certificate, that's demeaning us." Well, and they may be teaching in a school, we would take them no matter what. And early in that, one memory, if that's allowable, a group of teachers had come from various parts of the eastern region, of Nigeria, and they were all assigned to rooms, and one of them came down to the front desk and said, "There's no light in my room." So the front desk person went with her back to the room, put her hand on the wall, turned it, and the light came on. Amazing. She'd never seen anything like that before.
And of course, flush toilets were another issue. Totally.
Yeah, which with their pluses and their minuses, but I mean, but the university faculty had to grapple with the realities of life as it was for most Nigerians. They couldn't go in a, quote, ivory tower. And really, the starting of the Continuing Education Center was one device, a strategic device that really our team convinced the board to go along with.
Was there also outreach into surrounding communities as well?
We had some of that, you know. It was
With Maria, it was yeah. Every I think three times a week in the morning, she'd start out at before dawn because I would go with her, and she would take with her whatever she'd bought in the market that they would be able to buy in the market, and then she would teach the basic food groups, quote, with that kind of thing. The women would come. That's how you learn how hard the women work. The women would come with their babies on their backs and their loads on their heads on the way to market. And they would come and sit in the classroom that she'd borrow because it was too early for school to start for the hour. And she would show what to do with what kind of things and this kind of thing. And then they would go on to work for the rest of the day.
But, you know, for in sociology, Moselle Hill was one of the first teachers that we imported in that field, and he started what he called the Niger City Study. And so he had all the students out involved in really doing demographic and census-type gathering of data about people in that area, which then forced people to go back and forth into the villages. Agriculture has another excellent example. We brought a very fine agronomist from here who had also worked overseas in some other places. And he got there, he knew about corn because that's an important crop there as well as here. And on our hillside, he got a tractor and made straight rows and planted corn plants. And, you know, in the first few weeks or so, they looked beautiful. They were green and they were growing, and he was proud of that. It looked like anybody else's cornfield. And by about the sixth week, that it all turned purple. And by about the tenth week, there was nothing live and growing there. And you know, the local people were laughing at him, and he learned a lot, though. Because if you walked out, as Jan said, and we were doing village studies, incidentally, in the Edamame area, it's a three-level agriculture. You know, there are plants on the ground, there are vegetables, and then there are trees in the middle, and then the trees up above. You know, bananas in the middle, and palm oil up above, and down below, yeah, yams and cassava, and between those, some other vegetables growing. And a very well-organized pattern that had evolved over the years. So, and even Nigerians who had studied agriculture in the United Kingdom or in the USA with their books from Asia, they thought, for instance, you should always plant in straight rows. Why are you planting straight rows? Well, because they give all kind of agronomic answers. The real reason is that here we had a horse with a plow, and if the horse is gone, then you made a track to replace him, but you go a long way in a straight row. If you're bent over planting rice yourself, it's much better to have little half circles and back up as you plant, or your back gets pain. And as American agronomists have gone all over the world with their idea, you've got to plant in straight rows, which is absolute nonsense. If the faculty hadn't had to go out into the villages and work with people, they would never have learned these things because mm-hmm. they're not in the books. Mm-hmm. And that made them, in my view, better teachers of the kind of, quote, agriculture that we wanted to be taught in that place. And you can say the same thing for engineering in a lot of ways and water management. So anyway, the answer to your question is a vigorous yes.
Right. One of the things that's striking about the literature of the 1960s on development is the focus on the kind of the modernization model that some of the especially Eastern colleges in the United States said we need modern personalities, we need to end particularism, to develop universalism, we need
modernization.
And as it was a singer who said, we need a boatload of Protestant missionaries who will teach thrift and.
Yeah.
And so in retrospect, what would you say was the model of development that Michigan State faculty carried into Nigeria, and did that change over
they
time?
They started out with the same, I was going to say, the same stupid approach. The assumption, you know, when Harry Truman made his Point 4 speech, he was doing a very good thing, right? But the assumption was the Americans knew how to produce food, for one thing. They could go all over the world, and in a decade, we would solve the problem of human hunger. And I must say, the American Colleges of Agriculture, of which I'm a product, also believe this. If you could produce more, you could get rid of hunger. Well, you know, in the 50 years since then, we've learned that's a lot of nonsense. It doesn't make any difference how much you produce. People have to have effective demand. And if you don't, you can go to McDonald's, they can sell a million hamburgers. If you don't have a dollar, you don't get any. And you translate that to Nigeria, any place else, and I think our approach changed over the years. I think, and if we knew then what we knew now, it would have been different all along. But I say, over those 7 years, the Americans figured out we don't even know the questions, and therefore the answers we have are irrelevant in most of these applied fields. And also in the classics, because we didn't know enough about the traditional knowledge system. And so I would say, you know, that loaded question which you asked is very relevant, because what it did is it had an impact on not only me but others from MSU who came there. You know, at the same time period, some of my beloved colleagues went to Bangladesh and to try to do a very good thing under the great leadership of Dr. Hamid Khan, who really understood that system. But what did they do? Well, they brought tractors. You know, Americans farm with tractors. And they thought tractors will solve the problem. I went there some years later. I could see them all standing in a nice row, rusting. In fact, I think our current dean's office has them on the wall. Pictures, that's before they rusted. Because, you know, in the United States, historically, we have a surplus of land and a shortage of labor and a surplus of money. So without a horse, you couldn't farm very much, and the people in the towns needed. And later, without a tractor, you couldn't farm very much. So if you got a machine, a labor-saving device, because you had a shortage of labor, and you have plenty of money to buy those things, the tractor is an ideal thing for the USA. I'm going back 50 to 100 years. Okay, but if you go to a place where there's a surplus of labor and a shortage of land, where people, you know, this is, I don't know what the size of this room is, but it's no more than, what, 12 by 12 to somebody listening to this tape. You could feed a family with this if you do it very intensively with hand labor. Of course, you can grow, if the rains are good, you can grow 4 crops a year. If not, you could grow 3 crops a year. But you don't do that with a tractor. There's no place to turn the tractor around. So then our poor friends in Bangladesh had to start organizing, reorganizing, because the plots were too small, and doing all kind of social management to try to get people to cooperate with each other to fit the damn tractor, if I may say so. Well, we learned those lessons in the early years in Nigeria by trying things that were not appropriate. And I think that helped MSU as a university, and some of its faculty in the next few generations learned that the Americans don't have all the answers because the Americans don't know what the questions are. And you could say, you could take out the word American and put in other Europeans, or Japanese for that matter. But and yes, I think the move from this modernization approach to a collaborative approach, going through some in-between things, I think for us personally and for many of our colleagues at Nsukka, came out of that trial and error stage in which it was mostly error.
So the other interesting thing about that period is it's very early in African independence. It's a period of a great many stereotypes about Africa in the common culture here in the United States, which presumably Michigan State faculty and families took with them to Nsukka. How did that play out? How did the assumptions about our culture and theirs, and how did the learning that occurred there take place? And then how did it impact on what people did in their teaching and writing when they returned?
I want to just detour a little bit.
That's fine.
To say that one of the things, because we come from farm families and we started out from there, and we were determined personally to be attached to the village life there. So when the PhD from Cornell, a fine African gentleman, dear friend, would come to us, and he wanted his class that he was teaching at Nsukka to really see what life is like at the village, he would come to us. We would know people we could take him to.
Mm-hmm. And he did not have
He did not, because he came from that kind of elite.
Yes, so he had his PhD in agronomy from here. He was teaching agronomy, but he would come, and one or the other of us would get on the bus with him and his students, and we'd take him to a place where we could get off the bus and walk down the hill to a village where everybody knew us, and they were willing to let this happen. And his students could see how farming is really done in that part of Nigeria.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Well, A, he wanted to do that. It was his idea, not ours. B, he knew, because I said, well, take them. He said, well, I don't know where to go. I don't know anybody there. So on his own, he would never wander into mm-hmm. that. He was from a different social class, if you want to mm-hmm. look at it that way. And
there's a fragile elite in those areas, a very small one.
Yes,
and those,
yes.
And those.
Yeah.
But
and
there,
you
there
know,
is...
The ones who were educated, well, and Bab Staffen was a great illustration, because education is a little bit easier. You're a little, you can be elite even in the village school in a way mm-hmm. that you can't with agriculture, I think, in that sense.
Yeah, but he was very flexible. He
yeah. And but with our own, you know, faculty, I guess I was always impressed how most of the wives never went off the campus, except maybe to go to Port Harcourt, to the hotel and to swim and go to the movies. But they all just stayed right on the campus, and we were isolated from the life, real mm-hmm. life there. And I would say the same about many of the. One of the things that happened, of course, was a faculty of Nigerian faculty who came, most of them, well, they could have gone to England or the United States, but many of them had come to the United States to go to school and do their degree work, and they had married American black women who went back with them, quote, home, but who never went off the campus either mm-hmm. because that's really, they, it was so very different.
And sometimes they came back and found out they were not the only wife, they were one of the junior wives.
Or then they'd also find out that they were more American than they were black African, if you know what I mean.
It was a tough feisty period of social integration mm-hmm. For us and for them all. But you know, I think we've lost the track of...
Well, no, but did any of the faculty learn any of the local languages...
Some, a little. You know, part of the problem was that there was such a variety of languages, and because of Ezekwe's policy, we weren't expected to teach in Igbo or Efik or
right.
Yoruba or Hausa or Fulani or any of the. Everything had to be done in English, because that was the universal thing. And in the villages, that was a problem to us, but not too big. And we did a study for a while. In several different villages, I think 8 of them, and we employed diary keepers who kept track of what people were doing.
1966,
yeah.
The whole year.
Well, it was no. I sat with the village chief at one point, and with his son helping. I don't know. We need to recruit some people to be the diary keepers, and it'd be nice. Well, there were plenty of people who started schools and never finished, so they were school leavers, and they were very helpful. In being sort of go-betweens, mm-hmm. but for us to learn the local language was now you know, and we as
in an Anglophone country once in
because you know we had a very different experience in Nepal, and I don't know whether you want to get into that or not, but there after I'd been several times and finally the family moved out, we went to a small village, not the city of Kathmandu, but a third place, not where we were going to work. And started with the first month of intensive Nepali language, and we continued Nepali language teaching the whole time we were there. Mm-hmm. But because Nepali was a national language, and there was some English, and there were some other languages, and there were some local, smaller languages, but we were going to do village studies again.
And so the school leavers were very essential to as the bridge between the local people, the actual villagers, and those of us from the outside, mm-hmm. because they had enough English to get us tied up and involved in ways that and you see most of the faculty, well, it was very different life, and it was not, I guess, really all that easy in many ways.
Yeah. And individual faculty members, depending on their discipline, did get involved in how that discipline was being manifest in that country to the extent that they could. And in that sense, for us, it was a little bit easy because we wanted to do village studies. And we were surrounded by villages, and we had done some studies of village life and communication. And I must say, MSU was very good. We had started the Institute of International Communication or something like that in the new Communication College. They gave me a grant to work on these village studies because they want to know, you know, does anybody in the place have a radio, or does anybody listen to it, and what would they hear if they did, and things of that sort, and can anybody read in the village, and what's the impact of newspapers. And we, of course, had started a journalism school also there. And so MSU had supplied some additional funding, although I was really there doing this administrative job. I must throw in one more thing to put the context of Nigeria and the U.S. and our part of it, because we were working for this U.S. Agency for International Development and who was funding the work of Michigan State University. When I first started the job, I went to the State Department in Washington and to try to learn what they do and how the contracting process worked, which was, as you know, a new thing and an important thing still. But I asked them, you know, well, where do you people find out about Nigeria? They said, well, we have a Nigeria desk over in State. We'll take you over there. So I met the two, I thought, elderly gentlemen then, probably younger than I am now, who were they're really experts on Nigeria and the rest of Africa. So I said, where do you get your information? They said, frankly, we read the New York Times, because that's the best we can get. Later we discovered New York Times had one person covering all of West Africa. And I mean, that was the 1960s.
Right. Do you think faculty came back changed by their experience at all, or varied a lot?
Those who did well and survived and contributed came back very different people. Now, they were not all... I did most of the recruiting, and my record of failures is like most other administrators. We did send some people there who couldn't stay for various reasons and had to be brought home for health reasons and psychological reasons, but they couldn't adjust. For instance, one engineer who had been trained all his life in efficiency. You know, you have to get the most output for the least input and do it in the least time. And day after day, he was getting nothing done, and he would not sleep at night. And I talked with him, I talked with his wife, and we could talk about it, and he could understand what the problem was, but he couldn't sleep at all because he was really worried that he's not getting enough done for what he planned to get done. And eventually, we had to bring him home in a straitjacket. Mm-hmm. And there were some others like that. Some of them turned to alcohol, and they were a worse problem in a way. And so we were recruiting 15 new families each year, plus short-termers in between. And they would stay for a two-year tour. And in the archives, you can find records of that kind of thing. But there were many failures. And we ourselves learned a lot. The briefing given to people in the recruiting and in the briefing improved over the 7 years, I would say. And also, I learned very quickly, you know, if you were talking to a faculty member who assumes water comes out of a faucet and has never had to think of where it came from to there, and the electricity is always there in the lamp, that's the wrong person to send.
More than that, if they were married and taking a family, it became my job to be the snoop around the outside, you see, because whether the family can adapt or not would be a very critical thing in terms of whether the man can be successful or not. And it was tough for a lot of them. It really was.
Yeah. I mean, some people would go on a camping trip for a weekend, you know, and think, well, they can, quote, rough it for a weekend, and then they never notice. So. But for 2 years, after about the first 2 weeks, some of them would realize that they were not suited for that.
And I think the isolation, I mean, nobody appreciates the isolation nowadays. The isolation, no telephones, television, Lord knows. No, even radio was.
We could get BBC.
Touchy, but you were totally isolated, and that's very, very hard on many people.
We didn't even have telex then, so we could send cables back and forth from Enugu, that's 40 miles away, not from our campus. So you could send, or you could receive a letter from this campus 2 weeks after they sent it, if you were lucky. And
if there was a really crisis, I seem to remember one or two when they would. We had telephone in our house, the only one I think on the campus except in the offices.
Zeke had telephone.
Yeah,
his was better than ours.
But they would, if there was a crisis here, like, well, Earth, why, somebody would call Lagos, and Lagos would be struggling to call us to let us know whatever the crisis was.
And they didn't put that radio until about 3-4 months before the evacuation. So for most of the time, for the 7 years, we didn't have that kind of communication. Yeah, and you know, some people could live with that and not worry about it. You know, I haven't had a letter from my mother for a month and a half, and I know she writes every week. Well, it doesn't mean she's died, but some people would worry a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then to call her, you have to go to Lagos, really. And then the phone call doesn't go through.
Mm-hmm.
So
you know, the whole communication thing has changed so
much. We're so jealous of the modern world, you know, the cell phone and things like that, which are spreading throughout Africa.
Even there. The faculty were, some presumably really liked the experience and warmed to it, and were there some who signed on for an extension of their time there to stay and do their work?
Yeah, there were a few, but not many.
But I think that if they brought families, you know, there's a lot of pressures after 2 years.
To go back.
Particularly to get your kids back in school and things like that. So it's very hard. We had a few single men who were maybe more.
And some of them were, one of them was an excellent example, I would think, of John Hansen, because he went to the school. He was teaching education, but he didn't just start teaching. He went to many, many schools and visited and saw what they really do and what teachers start with, you know, uncertificated teachers. And he really was, he liked the place, and the people there liked him. And that was a great experience. Now, when we arrived on the scene, there was one other bachelor who had been recruited before I got onto the project, and he stayed in his room. And he had to be sent back. There were other cases which were more troublesome than that.
Well, of course, we had Andy Doyle and Carolyn, and their family went, and then they moved back here, and then Carolyn died, and Andy went back with just
For a second tour. He's on the first side, He did well, and he could see the importance of it. He was working in Continuing Education Center programming here. He went there and ran it for us for a while. And anyway, there are many fields in which people learned a lot that I would argue improved them professionally for the rest of their career.
Mm-hmm.
And at the other extreme, there were some who really lost 2 years by being there. And on the recruiting side here, when I was doing that on our own campus, I quickly discovered that if I go to the department chair and ask him, you know, who would be a good professor to send, he picks the professor who hasn't done anything in 10 years. They'd like to get rid of, but you're not allowed to shoot him in this culture. And he's got tenure. Yeah, that's your man. He's great. You should take him. And after the first two or three, it took me about 3 years to figure this out. Then I didn't do any recruiting through department chairs. I went, for instance, one of my achievements was Glenn Johnson in Ag Economics. I knew him a little, but I went to Glenn and talked to him, and he wasn't too interested in going. And I worked with him, it's like fishing for trout, you know, for a month or maybe 6 months, and finally he agreed to go. Then Dean Calvin, the dean of that college, called me in, and he said, "What in the hell are you doing? First of all, you shouldn't go to him, you should check me first, and then the department head, and then go to the man. Here you're going to ruin the best agricultural economist in America." And I said, "Yeah, that's exactly what I do. He'll be an internationalist. He'll never go back to just that kind of farm management that he's teaching here now." He was furious. But thanks.
Calvin was furious.
Yeah, the dean. But John Hanna was there, you see, and he was the backup all the time. I'll just give you one little administrative experience. Every year when the department sent their salary adjustments to deans, and the deans finally got to the president's desk, the people who were in Nigeria got adjusted up by him. And also the departments who were supportive of the project got recognized by the president and the deans who were supportive. So that I was in a uniquely positive position in a way. You know, here's a nobody going all over the campus from departments of psychology and general studies and engineering and whatever else, but I could work from underneath I would go to the department, you know, and talk to people there if I didn't know anybody in the department and find out who were really the productive ones and who were the best scholars and then talk to them. And if in the sorting out we figure out, no, because of his kid's age or something, he's not the right one. But then once they bid on the hook, the other thing was we learned a lot about how to prepare them with things to read in advance and stuff like that. Most of them didn't read it, but when they got there, they said, you didn't tell me this, and we get out a copy. Yeah, we handed you this, don't you remember? But, you know, one had to be sort of humane about it. And I think in our recruiting, we tried to tell them, look, we're not asking you to go on a sleigh ride. This is going to be tough work, and you're going to need everything you know professionally and your human capacity besides that. And if you're not interested, willing, and able to do that, it's better you don't go because it's going to be a mess.
And we did lose some people, too, who died.
Some didn't survive, yeah. Well, you know, we had malaria. We had these snakes and whatnot, and we had in the water all kind of waterborne diseases, and not the most healthy place to be.
Right. You know, George was always running between the campus and Lagos because of all the things needed to be done. So one time, early on, he'd taken me down to the new animal science.
In the veterinary.
Veterinary college.
Because we had started veterinary medicine there, which is another one of the new things.
And they did, and showed me this cold room with a shelf. That's for the body.
We were saved one shelf in our cold room because, you know, we don't have undertakers and things like that. And it gets hot. And if you have a body to deal with, although we, from the U.S. Consulate and whatnot, they would supply body bags and we could facilitate that. But in the beginning, what are you going to do with this body? So, and I was the only one on our team, really, who dealt with that issue.
Mm-hmm. But he was in Lagos.
Yeah.
and this was a faculty wife who died in front of my eyes. Because the veterinarian, who was her husband, was like every veterinarian I know, thinks he knows more medicine than the doctor. And I went to the place where the quote ambulance was to take the body, and the ambulance driver was not there. So I stole the Volkswagen bus thing and drove it up there, and somebody helped me put the body in the bus. And I took it and put it on that board.
Tough
and
experience.
And then George had to bring him home with the.
Yeah, then, of course, the husband who survived, thanks to Nancy, because she had gone and gotten the meds to come and pump his tummy and whatnot. But anyway, yeah, we had to bring him back to this country. I had to fly back with him. One or two cases that I had to fly back with personally. Sometimes if it was a minor thing, we could just hire some nurse to go with them. Mm. Yeah, so it was not all a big house party.
Happy time. How did the faculty and the MSU team relate to the Biafran independence and the politics of Nigeria at that time?
I would say it was mixed. You know, because we had people who had been to Nigeria and stayed there 2 years and done a very good job and gone back, and they were committed to, quote, Nigeria. And I think none of us were really in favor of the Nigeria. Neither was Colonel Juku, who was, or Azikiwe, to the idea of breaking off a separate Biafra. And some of our
faculty... It was very hard to lose our faculty from the West and the North
when they started moving...
Ordering them out, you know?
That was going on in 66, 67 period?
67.
I think
it
started
the first
in 66.
Part of
60, right. We were there from 65 to 67.
Yeah,
so
it was right about the first of the year of 67, right in that area somewhere.
When it got really...
And they, you know, they ordered them out. And they were good friends and neighbors, you know. You hated to have and kids who played with kids kind of stuff. It was hard on the families, I think, to have that first of the turmoil.
But, you know, I inadvertently got quite involved with the Biafran side. Not so much there as afterward, because the U.S. wanted to know, and you may recall, there were pictures in our papers of Biafran children starving and whatnot, and the U.S. government was wondering how serious that is. And it was long before Somalia, although we learned very slowly here. And, but similar pictures were being in our newspapers, and the issue was, well, what are they doing? And so the U.S. government asked the Nigerian government if they could send a small team into that Biafran enclave and look at the health and the food supply and the nutrition of the people. And the Lagos government said, no problem at all, just because we had U.S. government relationship with the Lagos government. Come here, we can tell you everything. There's no need to go into that enclave. And somebody in Washington got the idea that that's not going to be adequate. So they recruited a small group of Americans, one nutritionist, Jean Maillet, who was at Tufts, later became president of it. Jean had been in the Free French Army and had been one of the first ones into the Netherlands after World War II ended. So he had seen a lot of very hungry people, and he knew about that. Then was Roy Brown was a pediatrician. He knew about children's health. And George was the agriculturalist. And my task was to figure out within the Biafran enclave how much food is being produced and how much is coming in on this on the various airlifts in. And so the three of us went into the Biafran enclave. And I don't know how much you want to hear about that. So we survived it, and we stayed a while, and we learned an awful lot. And after I got back to the United States, I found myself going around here and there explaining the Biafran problem, what's going on there, giving speeches and whatnot. And that's not really not what I wanted to do for the rest of my career. And sometime within that next 6 months or a little longer, the University of Newcastle upon Tyne in England invited me to come as a visiting professor for several months to do something. And I thought, gee, this is good. I'll escape the Biafran thing by being in Newcastle. And I went there, and they gave me a nice office the first day with, you know, clean desk and clean shelves. And here's where you'll sit, and we'll come talk to you after a while. We'll have a little faculty meeting and blah, blah, blah. So I sat down there, and I was emptying my briefcase. There was a knock on the door. And I opened the door, and here's two Nigerians standing there. And they said, we're members of the Biafran Students Association. We'd like you to meet with us. So I said, there's no escape.
Right. Right. So, but I assume that the faculty were in love with the Nigerians that they knew, and they were increasingly from the east as the Westerners and Northerners left.
Yeah, because the others came the other way, you see.
Oh, I see. So you had Eastern.
Eastern region people who were in Lagos teaching at various institutions.
Or in the north.
Or in the north. They came to Nsukka, whereas our people scattered. That exchange, I think, from an academic perspective, was a good thing. Both ways. You had a lot of teacher exchange, you could say, you wouldn't have had if it wasn't forced. It was not a comfortable thing while it was happening. And I think all of them hoped that, you know, there'd be a peaceful settlement soon. In fact, even at the time that our team was evacuated, we thought, well, it'll end very soon. Some of my colleagues hung around for a short while. Poor Nancy arrived in Lagos with this plane load of the wives and children that was loaded in Port Harcourt. And they landed in Lagos, and somebody from the U.S. Embassy came in.
Got up and said, where's Mrs. Axon? I've already got my own little kids, you know. Where's Mrs. Axon? I'm the team leader of all these wives and children. Most of those women had never traveled without their husbands. Uh-huh. They didn't even know how to handle money or passports or anything. It was a really tough time on the women. Mm-hmm. And the children, they had to leave. And people like me, I had to take my little guy from his daddy and his baby nurse.
Yeah, if you could have taken the baby nurse with you, it would have been a lot easier.
Yes.
So did you stay in Lagos then?
No, we got on the next plane. But I worked all that day on with the people at Pan Am. George had given me a special Pan Am card, thank God, to get everybody who was on our wives and children out where they wanted to go, because many of them, their husbands were coming to meet them somewhere on their, quote, vacation kind of thing, or they were not yet, they're 18 months out of the United States, you see, and they were stalling around somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So a few stayed in Lagos, many went to Europe. Those of us with little wee kids went on the next flight out, the night flight out. And
to London?
No. Yes. to London, because that's where I lost. Oh, God, yes. To London. And no, that's where we were. Sorry, George. From Nigeria.
Yeah, from Lagos, you went to London.
Yeah, all of us went to London. No. Where did I lose the kids? In London is where I lost them. But I still had people, I know, I still had all the people who were going to some other place. It was exactly the time that the...
The Six-Day War was on. Some people
Egypt,
went from Lagos
to
Cairo.
They were evacuating at the same time. So the pressure on the evacuation stuff was really tough, and they weren't ready to evacuate us.
That's the 67 Israeli-Egyptian War.
Right, exactly. And... So I worked in London with the Pan Am people there, and Miriam Kelly was with us. We brought out all the women were to come out. That's what the aide had ordered, even if they were faculty members. And she took my kids and David Doyle, who was also my kid at that point, they went to a hotel, and I stayed and worked with them. So when I got all done with everybody settled where they were supposed to go and everything, then Pan Am said, well, you're go to this hotel. I went to that hotel and checked in at the desk. There were no family there. I must have looked like death going over. I thought, my God, I've spent all day. I've lost all my own family. And they said to me, don't worry, we'll find them. So they found them in another hotel around the airport there, and put me in a taxi and sent me over there. I got to this room, and there was somebody asleep on each bed, and somebody asleep under each bed, and everywhere else. I had time for a shower. And to call Irv Wyeth and tell him where
Irv
everybody
was our campus backup man at that time.
Where everybody was scheduled to go, because their families are all worried about where are they, so they would know. And then we got on the plane to fly to New York. We got to New York, and Dean Taggart was there. He wanted to know about every single person. George's brother and his brother-in-law were there. I had one kid who had gotten on my plane with me from Ibadan school with some crummy infection all over his feet and no clothes, because he brought, like every other boys, they packed what
he
was
brought his soccer shoes.
Yeah, their soccer shoes or their records or something like that. Oh, we had a crazy time. A crazy time.
Coming out. So you planned to go back, and did any of the faculty ever make it back to Nigeria that came out of the Nsukka experience?
I think the answer to that is yes, but not many. I don't know if Carl Eicher ever went back. Maybe not Carl Liedholm. He had gone just a little bit earlier, because I think Mrs. Liedholm had their first baby, so I had taken them across the line to the west side to Benin City, and she had flown from there. They might have gone back, because they had, or Glenn Johnson, these were the economists, they had connections with the Nigerian government, they might have gone back. Nancy went back once. You didn't go to all in Suka, you went to Ibadan once.
Yeah, I went back for being healthy crisp.
But I was very anxious to go back, and I applied for this was after the Biafra, after the war ended, and I applied for a visa, and I was instructed that there's no need for you to apply for a visa anymore, because you're not going to get one ever, so forget it. So I decided I wouldn't go. But then the network told me, and this is after another year or two, that yeah, if you apply to the consulate in New York, they'll give you a visa.
Because he had a student, a Nigerian student.
Yeah, and I had a Yoruba student who was doing his master's thesis on forestry, and he wanted to meet me in Lagos and look at his thing. And I don't know whether you want to bother with that story. I was then working with the Musea Consortium and traveling quite a bit, and I was in, anyway, they gave me this visa. I was in Addis doing something else, and I got an Ethiopian Airlines plane, which goes from Addis to Nairobi to Lagos to Accra. And as I was sitting on that plane, I was thinking, well, there's three things that could happen when I get off the plane at Lagos. You know, one is they could tell me to get back on the plane. That's the easy one. two, I could just get in with all those other passengers and walk through sometimes immigration and customs. They're not very efficient. I just walk right through. They'll never say anything. And three is the Lagos jail, in which I had no interest at all. And I got in the airport. Our plane landed, and I was taken to the airport on the bus to the terminal. And I got online to public health. Was no problem. But I got to immigration. I gave my passport to the immigration officer, and he pulled the drawer open and looked there. And he was the guy with one stripe on his surgery. He said, "Just a moment." He talked to the next man, which was a man with two stripes on his thing. So they changed places. Then he looked in the drawer, and he looked and he said, "Stay right here, don't go away." And he went in the back office and made some calls. And then I was thinking, well, you know, option one is gone. Maybe options two or three will work out. But he came back. He didn't even speak to me. He said, "Is there a representative of Ethiopia Airlines on this in this area?" And the young man came, and he was Ethiopian. He said, "Is that your plane out there?" "Yes, sir." "That plane may not leave this airport unless this man is on it." And he put his finger back at me. So, anyway, they were cooperative more or less, and I ended up in Accra that night. And that's as close
why
as
why do you think that they targeted you for?
They didn't like the report that our team made about the Biafran exercise. You know, we were sent officially and publicly by the U.S. government. We drafted our report on the planes on the way back, and
he was a senator with them.
Yeah. Charles Goodell, he was senator. They sent him as our political cover. They thought if he had a politician, anyway, he was only a short-term senator, so he was expendable if he didn't get back. But he was our cover, Senator Goodell. But because he was with us, we got through customs and immigration. We went to Lisbon. From there, we flew to the island of Sao Tome. From there, we went on the airlift into Biafra, and that's another whole story. But and we got out somehow. But we were then called to Washington to meet with government officials. We had prepared a report. They put that in the Congressional Record. We had the National Press Club had a luncheon for us, and so each of the three of us gave a little message to them, and it was sort of no secret what we were doing. And that's when I started getting these invitations to go here and there and tell people what's going on in Biafra. Mm-hmm. The Nigerian government, needless to say, did not like that. And I had not been back to Nigeria. A couple of times in more recent years, as you may recall, I was invited by people at Otsuka to go, but they could never get approval.
You know, we have failed pretty thoroughly here in terms of talking about really the other kinds of things, except our own personal life, and I don't think that's what really you had in mind.
No, it's. I think it's a mixture of the personal and the institutional that we wanted, and I think it's. We want to try to. We have reports on the library shelves and in the archives, but we want to bring some human touch to those, and not just to have you report or write a draft to another book. So I think it's perhaps it's time for us to shift gears and talk a little bit about after the Niger experience and as you came back to Michigan State. Shall we do that?
Sure.
We can come back to other other aspects of the Nigerian experience. When you came back, what were you assigned to do at Michigan State from after the?
Nancy, tell first, and then I'll tell.
You didn't prepare me. Can I remember that?
Yeah, you were in human ecology, which was then home economics, and you were teaching the undergraduate required courses.
Yeah, but I don't think I did that in 67, honey.
Well, you don't have the exact year.
Well, anyhow.
I'll tell him why.
I did most of that in the 70s. That's what I did until we went to Nepal, and some for about a year after we came back from Nepal. But yeah. I found in all of that I... I'm much happier in the real world.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the academic world is fine when you've got kids that you need to be at home with, but once the...
Yeah, I think you did several assignments abroad in that interim for FAO in Ethiopia and maybe one or two other places.
I worked in Ethiopia, Swaziland, Lesotho, and Botswana.
And what were you doing for FAO?
Reviewing their programs there.
Reviewing programs.
Yeah.
And food security and...
Mostly home economic schools that they had supported.
I see.
In terms of that. And after that, then I went to South Asia, and I've worked in South Asia always, except at one point when George was working for the UN, the FAO asked me to go back to, that's when I went back to Ethiopia, I think.
For the second time.
For the second time, yeah. And FAO, the people in to look at those kind of things and say, no, she can't do this because he's a rep.
I was the country rep in Nepal at the time.
And my unit said, what do you mean? She worked for us before
they were
he
just
worked
like,
for us.
They were just like Michigan State University. You're the spouse of a professor. Right. You're nobody. And so, they refused. But then...
They went to the director general and got his approval every time I worked for them after that. And I did work in Ethiopia. Yeah. At that time, too, reviewing again their programs in agriculture and home economics in Elmaya.
Yes, that's the agricultural faculty
in
at Elmaya
from and one other place further south later.
Mm-hmm. I think I'd have to look at the map. It's too long. I didn't come with my.
All right, that's fine. So you were teaching in human ecology, what is now human ecology?
Yes,
when
became human ecology when
you were
started
here, right.
Yes.
And George, what were you assigned to?
Well, first I didn't know what to do, because we had cleanup things to do for that project, and I was given a room in the International Center, and then Glenn Taggart got the brilliant idea that, we need somebody who has been in the field working on projects out of their office. So they created the post of assistant dean for overseas operations. And I was appointed as assistant dean for overseas operations.
Taggart was the dean of international studies and programs at that time. Had he been in that post when you left to go to Nigeria the first time? Was he already?
He was already the dean.
He was already the dean.
Yeah, he stayed the dean. In the interim, I was involved some in the setting up of the area studies centers and institutes.
He was the dean. He was also the acting vice chancellor at Zuka.
There was a time toward the end when they didn't have a vice chancellor there, and Glenn Taggart went on leave from here, went to the University of Nigeria, and became the acting vice chancellor for X months until we could find one. I don't remember now. It's 6 months, I'm guessing. And Ralph Smucker was the acting dean during that period, and then Glenn came back and resumed that post. But he was back in that post by the time the project ended, and I returned.
I bet it was a year.
Well, it might have been a year. The records will show that.
Well, Elaine, when Elaine went to school with Kathy.
Back here?
No, there.
Oh, for that year. Well,
so.
Could have been a year, maybe longer than a year.
So, so international studies and programs existed then in the International Center that...
Well, our first offices were here in this building when I first started working with that project.
Here in the library.
Here in the library.
Uh-huh.
On the fourth floor, I guess, or the third floor. And but plans were afoot to build the International Center. And I was involved in that because even in my last year or two as campus coordinator before I went to Nigeria, I was working a little bit on other projects. And I had an office in Wells Hall where the Asian Studies Center started, and was involved with those kind of things. After I came back, my reassignment was to work with all of the overseas projects, wherever they were. We had them in Colombia and in Brazil and in Thailand and in Turkey and various other places. And so, I'm not the kind of administrator who believes reports that are written. I have to go there and put my hands on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I traveled to all of our projects, wherever, sometimes with Glenn Taggart. He also wanted to go, and I did that for several years, I guess. And then, we started this consortium. That had started really before I got back, but...
This is the Midwest University's Consortium for International Activities,
so-called
MUSEA.
Midwest University's Consortium for International Activities. And really the first draft of that, Rodden Dangerfield, was at the University of Illinois, and he came up here and sat with Glenn Taggart and they in this building and drafted the proposal to Ford Foundation to fund that thing. But neither of them had a typewriter, and I had a typewriter. So I wheeled my typewriter into that room, and that's how the Musea Consortium got started.
What year was that? And
oh, gee, well, I can count backwards.
You went to and spent 76, and 7 years there would make it 69.
Could be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be about 69. And then on the personal side, the consortium headquarters was at the University of Illinois. There were four universities, Indiana University, University of Wisconsin, Illinois, and Michigan State. And so they wanted me to go to the headquarters at Illinois, and I said, I'll go to the University of Illinois for 1 year. I had some friends there, and I thought if I can teach a little bit in their department, that would work out. And Nancy didn't want to sever her relationship, but we did go to Urbana-Champaign for 1 year. And I started traveling all over. Of course, Musea then had projects in more different places than just Michigan State. We had some Musea projects, and then we had projects at the various universities. And so I traveled and visited all of those and did various things. And toward the end of the year, we had a board of directors that had two people from each of the universities. And I think one of my jobs was to get more universities into it, so I think maybe Purdue had started then. I was working with Ohio State as the next one, and then later Penn State. But I said to that board, look, I want to go back to Michigan State and stay on the campus there. That's where I belong, and that's where I'll continue to teach a little bit while I do this stuff, because I'm not just doing this stuff to be a full-time forever administrator. I want to teach, and what I'm learning in this process I want to share with grad students. So Michigan State had agreed to that arrangement. So after that first year, they moved the headquarters of the consortium here. We kept the treasurer in Illinois because he was doing very well, and we had the bank accounts at Urbana. So then for 7 years, I worked as the president and executive director of Musea, that consortium, and traveled a lot and learned a lot. I'm back to President Hanna's original idea. Why are we bothering with this international work? We have a faculty that needs to get experience all over the world and learn what their field is. If you're an entomologist, you need bugs not just from Michigan or from the Midwest. You need the bugs from all over the world in your collection and soils and any other kind of thing. If you're a medical person, you've got to know what healthcare delivery is like in places where there's no electricity. You can't just learn how it works here. So we organized groups of faculty from each of the universities as an international medicine group, as an international health group, I guess it was an international agriculture group, whatever. And they were instrumental not only in cooking up projects, but in organizing staffing for projects so that you could have a project that Purdue was doing, but there was some Michigan State and Wisconsin people on it and things of that sort. So that's what I was doing for 7 years. And the end of the sixth year, my administrative officer here in the International Center said, George, I've just done the arithmetic. You spent more days in the air last year than you did on the ground. And less than a third of the days, I think, did you come to East Lansing? And I said, that's it. Maybe Nancy was involved in that. So I told the board, look, I'll stay for 12 months. That'll be my seventh year. And at the end of that, I'm going. And I hope you recruit somebody else to take my place, because we don't want this thing. And as boards, governing boards do, they didn't do that. But I was working with the Sepal project, and one of the things that I was developing, I'd been working a lot in India and Pakistan, and I was always flying from East Pakistan to West Pakistan, looking out the window to the north. And there were these beautiful Himalayan snowpack. I wanted to go there. I never had an excuse to go there. Anyway, one thing led to another. I won't go through all the details, but it took several years to get this project set up, really, to do something like we had done in Nsukka, but to do it in Nepal and focused on agriculture. And Musea was going to run it, and MSU was going to be the main university, and we recruited staff from Ohio State, maybe one other place, and Illinois. And we had a team leader from Illinois, and everything was set, except about 2 months before the project was to seem so out there, the guy in Illinois got elected as chairman of the Agronomy Society for USA, and he said, I can't go, I'm going to stay here. And then the aid mission director from Nepal came to Washington once, and I met with him there. And he said, you know, we've looked over this whole thing. We don't think anybody else can make this thing run. We need you to come personally and be the team leader for it. And I said, you know, I'm doing other things. And anyway, I'm not going to leave Nancy here while I go. And he said, we'll put you both on our team. And I said, well, if we can arrange all that, maybe we'll do it. I guess before that I had said no, because at one time the man who was rector of the university, Mohan Mansanju, came to East Lansing, and it was a holiday, so we couldn't...
Labor Day weekend.
Yeah, so he was staying at the Kellogg Center, but they closed their dining room, so he came to our house to eat. And during the meal, he raised the question. He said, you know, the truth of the matter is that you helped plan this school, and I had worked with a planning team. I did a lot of that when I was with MSU. We organized a planning team from all of our universities with counterparts from the other country, whatever it was, and we would do the planning for some kind of institution building activity. Well, I had been the U.S. chairman of the group, and there was a Nepali counterpart, and we had made this plan. But Mohan Man said, you know, George, you were the one who said we can't do it in the city of Kathmandu. We have to go out to a rural place and start our school there, because none of the book learning agriculturists knew anything about farming in that country, just like a lot of other places. And for several reasons, he said, look, you made the plan. Now we want you to put your body where your mouth was. Go there and stay, because we have trouble getting faculty to even go there. And so then he talked to people back there. Anyway, at MSU, when AIDS said, okay, we'll have two of you to go. It was then going to be a four-person team, Nancy and I and two others, one from here and one from Ohio State. And my dean, Ralph, said, no way, you can't go. We need you here. And Nancy's dean in human ecology said, no way, Nancy. She's teaching undergraduate courses with large loads and nobody
else
wants to do it.
So
both those deans said, no, you can't go.
This was when? Was this roughly?
This was about 1975.
Okay.
5, 6.
1975.
Yeah. And so we said, we're sorry, but our administration won't let us go. Well, the U.S. ambassador in Kathmandu sent a message. Cliff Wharton was then here as our president. He sent a message to Cliff, and he says, what kind of university is it? Well, you have faculty members who want to come here, and your administration will let them go. So Cliff calls the two deans into his office and said, what's going on here? Well, they each tried to explain it. He said, look, you've got to give them a chance. If they really want to go, rather than say they should have the right to go. And I don't know about Nancy's needs, but I think that Ralph came to my office, and these are not his exact words. I can't remember them anyway. But so, look, if you insist on going, I can't keep you from going, but you'll pay a price later. and Nancy had discussions with her dean and her department chair.
Discussion with her.
Anyway, we went. And that was, you know, I had decided, after all these years of going all over the world dealing with the major problems of international development, I need to go to a small rural village someplace, like we had done in Nsukka. In Edamame is the town that we spent a lot of time with, and get reacquainted with reality. But there I knew that, different from the Nsukka experience, we would need the language, because no one spoke English there, and we didn't speak Nepali. And to go to such a place and really get off the campus. We don't want to stay on the campus and just talk to those who have a college education from outside. We wanted our faculty to go there. In fact, part of our rationale is the faculty has to go to the farmers and learn how people farm in this kingdom before they can teach it, or bring the farmers to your classroom, because they know.
Right.
Anyway, so we spent a while in language training first, and then we went down there and brought language trainers, and we learned the Nepali language enough to do interviews. And I learned a lot about Nepal, and I guess we stayed there 2 years in that instance. Nancy teaching on the campus and me teaching on the campus and doing research in the field and publishing on our findings and things like that in several different locations in that kingdom. We came back here to, and I think by that time Nancy was doing consulting with the Ford Foundation and others, and FAO, and not bothering with academe.
I taught 1 year when I came back.
1 year and then stopped. And I worked in ISP and mostly in getting grants. In fact, you and I worked together, David, on getting the money
for CASID.
For CASID.
Starting CASID and Women in International Development.
We started with during the program. And I mean, right. Worked on those kind of things. Right. And then I was in Washington really working on some of those. And I stopped in the FAO office there because I knew the guy who was head of it, not that I had any connections with the FAO. But I was a little student of FAO because it's a large organization and I'm a sociologist and I used to stop there and seeing how they were organizing themselves because they started as a library and then they became activists. Anyway, he said, how would you like to go back to Nepal? And I said, gee, if you need a sweeper for your office, I'd be ready to go. He said, we need a new representative there. And if you're willing, that he gave me an application form to take back to the Holiday Inn where I was staying and type it out and give it to him. And sure enough, one thing led to another.
It's noon.
Yeah, it's noon. We're supposed to quit. I'll just quickly finish. Anyway, I went to Nepal for 3 years. I went for two because you can't get leave here for three, but then they extended for another year.
No, they didn't extend. They said, you know, we're not, even if we have to extend, you won't get it. So
yeah.
Don't ask.
Mm. That was for the fourth year.
Go back another year. Mm. It was the third year.
Yeah, at the end of the third year. Mm. Well, anyway, we were there for three full
yes,
years.
There were 3 years in Nepal as the FAO representative.
Yes, the FAO representative. Then I came back here. I did, and I started teaching in the Resource Development Department, where I'm still teaching, even though I teach now only on the Internet all three semesters. I think nobody at Michigan State has taught that long. Because I started in 53. This is 2003, and I'm in the middle of the summer semester now. But anyway, maybe that answers your question of what we do next. We're 2 years in India with
right.
the FAO on a second tour.
I'm trying to think how we should proceed. But would you... I think there's a lot to talk about still, and would you like to continue this afternoon, or would you like to continue now for another 45
minutes? Are tech people
minutes?
Willing to do that for another little while?
I think they're looking like we've had it.
Well, it's up to you in a way.
Would
you like to break now or continue later? How do you feel?
It's up to you. It's up to you.
It may be better if they can stay, to stay and finish.
Sure.
But if you'd rather go and take a break.
Absolutely. We'll just keep going.
All right.
You got another jug of water?
I'll get some water.
Yeah, that will help. Thank you.
Here are the copyright releases. Before you leave, you have to.
Can you do a thumbprint or you want a signature?
Ah, signature will be fine. I'm also going to turn the light on and take a few quick pictures.
Oh, I don't have any lipstick on. You can't take pictures. I'm dead.
We'll see you later visually.
We'll colorize
okay,
you.
Fine.
Color that's
fine. I sent a picture to my driver in Nepal because we still keep in touch. And
I'm listening.
And he said to me, he sent a letter back, and he said, oh, I cried when I saw you. You look so old. And I thought, well, Nancy, that tells you. You better do something about that.
Would you like to?
That's
what it is. This is a black. No, this is a
you want
pink one?
I got a red one, but it said that they don't care, I don't care.
Well, I think this is interesting, and it gives some color to the dry text.
Yeah.
On Sukkot.
You're using 280?
Yeah.
Okay.
At 85704.
Yeah.
I'll use Nancy's when she's finished here.
You can even make it mine if you
have anything else. Okay, thank you.
There was some years in ISP when the students called me the Green Dean because I signed everything in green.
Take a look at these questions, George, because I think the...
Which ones that David really wants to answer and put places?
Well, I mean, I did this awfully early and revised them last night. So I'm not so...
Well, you asked some.
But I think some of those, as I look on them, are not so key.
The growth and the strength of the African Study Center.
Well,
we talked about that.
Right, but one thing I want to talk about, you were in the position of overseeing the projects at the time the Vietnam project
was over.
It was over by the time you got to it.
Yeah.
Do you feel like talking about that at all? I mean, it looms large.
I don't know much about that, but as Nancy knows, I'll talk about anything. Whether I know anything or not. Because I think Ralph Smucker had come back from Vietnam before I left to start my work in Nigeria about that time.
Although you went back that far, didn't I?
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't pay attention to that at all.
But then there was, what was in the, after you returned in that 68 to 72 period, there was... There was protest on campus.
Yeah,
right,
there was a lot of controversy
point.
That, and you know, well, up to when it was 67 is when we left Nigeria. Up until then, I was immersed 100% in Nigeria and that project and things related there too. What was going on in Southeast Asia just didn't enter my mind. I was spending more time with there than here, and I wasn't paying attention to the U.S. newspapers, and I knew there was some turbulence there in Vietnam, but that, you know, if you'd asked me then where and how many and when
right,
the Americans came, I couldn't know any of that.
But when did you take over the International Society for International Projects then?
That was in late in 67.
You had to go milk the cow, huh? Thank you.
I could look back because, oh, actually,
no, that's
actually
all right.
In my thing, I've got a biodata which has all these dates.
I was thinking as we started this morning, we should have asked you for your biodata to go with the interview.
If you carefully pass.
Does that normally get filed, Peter, with the interview? Do you know a resume or biodata of the speaker?
We can do whatever
speaker?
We like.
Yeah. That would be a good idea.
Yeah. It's too long. I mean, this thing is 21 pages long.
That's fine. That's the more detailed, the better. To go with it.
And I have it in my computer. I can print it out tomorrow.
Thank
so
you very much.
He wants it. Now you asked something about the years, huh?
Well, I was just trying to... I don't know when all this... When that Ramparts article came out, which is still follows us, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Nationally, that's... I get asked, oh, you're from the university.
Yeah, you say you're from the university that got their grant renewed when nobody else did for African studies. Never mind the other stuff.
Yeah. Well, from 1969 to 1976, I was working for MUSEA. That was Illinois, Ohio State, Minnesota.
But I mean, you went to
Wisconsin.
Illinois.
We only lived in Illinois.
We lived in Illinois 1 year, then we came back here. Uh-huh.
So that was in the. So you were doing MUSEA work at the time of the Vietnam protest here, right?
I was aware of that. I was a visitor to this campus, but I was
right.
Not here all the time.
Right. It's interesting to see MUSEA working now. By the way, you know, with Phil Smith as the executive director of it, and in its reconstituted form.
I really know very little. I worked for that consortium for 7 years. Again, those 7 years, Museo was my whole life.
Right.
And after that, they haven't been thoughtful enough to tell me what's going on. And it's all right.
They probably were the first year, and you told them what they should do differently.
I think they have. They're going in different ways, you know, with a different set of universities now.
Well, you know, they changed some of their. The presidents used to put pressure on me to get more projects and get more money. And I said, look, the reason for having the consortium is to get our faculty and graduate students into as many different countries as we can, long enough to learn what's going on there and stay for a while. And so these short-term consultancies, especially if you have to hire the faculty from some other university, I didn't want to get into that. Now, I had to do some of it. I said, if you want to run a business here and see how much money you can make, get somebody else.
But now you know that's what they're doing. They're doing that everywhere.
Yeah. So?
Are we ready to be back online again?
We probably aren't. I don't care.
It's just as well if we are.
Are we still typing?
No?
Yeah, it's still
right.
Sorry.
Okay, so that's
you may ask fine. Anything you like.
No. Well, one of the things, when I came to Michigan State in the late 70s and then through the 80s, I've been struck by the number of other universities that have sent people here to look at international studies and programs at MSU is seen as a model for kind of a matrix linkage to colleges and to some centralized program. What was the kind of ethos and the kind of philosophy about international studies and international programs, and that when you came back from Nigeria in those years, what was it heavily focused on projects? Was there a strong emphasis upon content studies of foreign peoples and languages, and what was the tenor of it?
You know, the area study centers had been started, maybe all of them. Starting new area study centers and new institutes was a big part of our effort. I remember one of my tasks in that period was to go to the College of Agriculture and convince them that they should pay a little of the cost of the Institute of International Agriculture. They were paying zero. We were paying it all. So our strategy really for setting up an institute, if the dean was willing to provide all the funding, and most deans are willing to take your money no matter what, but they, when it came time to cost share and make it a joint venture, there was a lot of difference. And so one of my tasks was to go and pound the table of the relevant dean. And you know, you remember the starting of Cassida, that we had a dean in social science who really had no interest in, and to convince her that, look, we need to have some kind of international unit based there, even though it'll have faculty from all over. And anyway, that's the kind of things that I was involved in at that time. But when we first got back, knowing that we absolutely needed things like an African Study Center, we had learned. Because if you have a faculty who has no clue what's going on besides in Michigan, to say nothing of the U.S. of A., the chance of their research, scholarship, international development program activity and whatnot succeeding and being appropriate is not very good. Even if they are the best there is, and you know, we had them in psychology, we had them in economics, we had them in various fields, and the obvious kind of thing is, you know, like the soils. If a professor of soils had never seen a volcanic soil before, didn't know that there were such things because he'd been trained here, and didn't realize that there were some differences between a volcanic soil and our kind of soils, and that kind of stuff, that the research that they do globally and the research they do here is just not going to be as good. And anyway, I think some of those things are very obvious now and part of the but the challenge to ISP. I think from the beginning the faculty said you can have a unit, but it really can't have any clout, which means you may not give degrees and you may not give tenure. So, you know, if you can give money, we'll take it. And I'm oversimplifying now, perhaps, but I think over the years, my experience, if you have no clout with deans and administrators, even if you have a provost who is verbally supportive, you can't do much, which is one reason I think that I feel now, you know, by the year 2003, having a ISP that can't give appointments, just gives you a sort of lame duck. And as you may remember, we've had many committees study this, but every 6 years we have another committee study it. And my own leaning at the moment is that, yeah, the international centers are sufficiently important, and the internationalization is so important for every discipline we have, that there has to be a way that an international unit, whatever it's called, can participate vigorously in the choice of faculty and the giving of tenure and the financing of the whole business, which to me means you have to set up a separate academic unit. You can call it whatever you want to, but it has to be able to deal with the deans, and you know most of this stuff better than I do, but it has to be able to deal with the deans with clout. And if you have to have a provost and a president behind you. But if they're way, way behind you, it doesn't help too much.
Right. Well, I think the one place that did happen was with the African Studies Center when it lost its Title VI grant in the early 70s. And they stepped forward to, the provost stepped forward to create about five positions that brought a whole series of faculty here that then kind of reestablished MSU is a major center in with new appointments in history and anthropology and political science and sociology, linguistics that put us back on track and have helped us to be strong now. And the half of those salary lines of each of those faculty is actually still in the African Studies Center. That's the one center that has those, any piece of
and
the faculty line.
And that's the one center that has the vigor and
right.
Continuity.
Although I think the, you know, what happened was that in the vigor of international studies in the period that you were there, there was an explosion of the number of faculty involved. There was a hiring in departments.
Yeah.
But now we're at the point where a lot of those are retiring and leaving and not being replaced with internationalists. So there is a Michigan State actually is at a crossroads in that regard about what it's going to do about faculty, because there are no longer so many of these projects that create experts like yourself
this
with
our
depth
vehicle.
Of experience.
You know, the goal was to get the faculty and grad students at least, although we had undergraduate programs too, out into the world firsthand to learn about it. Now how could you do it? And you could get money to do a technical assistance project. You couldn't get money just to do research.
Mm-hmm.
You could get a little bit, but not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole strategy, really, to get technical assistance projects going was not because of our great technical knowledge and what we could, quote, do for them, but to get our faculty go there and learn. Well, that's a difference that I think has been intentionally kept fuzzy.
Well, and don't you think that the whole world, frankly, and certainly has become more global in many ways than it was in the 1960s when we started out?
Yeah, you could do it a different way now. You know, the advent of the computer and the internet has changed everything, and it's not over yet. But the changes in terms of international study, international collaboration, are so different now than they were then. That's probably what we're saying. A lot of it is obsolete. But what you would do in the 21st century is certainly different than what you do in the second half of the 20th century. It's tough to explain that to some of our own colleagues in the department where they've been teaching for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole bricks versus clicks conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And since I'm one who teaches full-time on the internet and doesn't need a classroom and doesn't need a dormitory or any of those things, and how long can public funds be used to build facilities, which you certainly needed to have a school 200 years ago or 150 for our centennial.
And when you look at
what
that...
do you need it now?
When you look at that in terms of where the internet is all over the world, certainly the opportunity for clicks learning is a lot wider than the opportunity for bricks learning in that sense.
And doing project learning, if you were going to take a team to a place like Ansuka today, where they would all have internet access, my guess is recruiting would be a lot easier. And keeping people there longer would be a lot easier. Now, having the power off would still be a challenge from time to time, but that happens in East Lansing.
Right. Do you think that Michigan State was successful in getting a carryover from the international project experience that the faculty had into what was going on in the classroom, the teaching, and the shape of the scholarship that was being produced?
Well, certainly faculty. In some areas, you'd have to say that in the lead home Johnson kind of sections.
Yeah, I think there are, you know, it varies and it changes. But there are many departments which will never be the same because of what happened.
Oh, the lights are on.
So you think that, for instance, the agriculture projects do lead to change in the...
And it also depends on some of them. Some technical assistance projects or whatever. And some of them are basically research projects these days more and more. Well, you know, if the professors who are learning that can't use it in the classroom and they publish about it in their discipline, so if you read their journal, you're finding international articles. And it seems to me, yeah, there's a trend line that was having its start at the end of World War II and is still moving in a what I would call a positive direction. Of course, you know, the alternative is to ignore the rest of the world. Now, we have some people we elect for high office who do that, and they're going to pay a price, and we'll all pay a price for that. And so, it's possible to, just close your eyes and your ears and pretend that you're the only player on the field. Well, even if you win a game, nobody cares.
The other thing I was going to say is, if I may be excused from dragging in a second generation, but just the very fact that we lived where we lived in Nepal, and Bill grew up there, and now I still read dissertations for foreign students who need a little English help for their dissertation. I've just finished reading one about Chitwan, where we lived. Bill's PhD student now, the change in that rural area in these 25 years is just unbelievable, and it really woke me up to this whole thing, particularly the aspirations for, because this was a study on population kind of stuff, the aspirations for daughters. When we were 25 years ago visiting secondary schools, counting on our fingers the number of girls who were in school, and now their goal is for them to go to college, the parents' goal is for them to go to college. That just says that what we do at the university is getting smaller and smaller in terms of the larger picture, I think.
And going along with that, by the way, is the large immigration, the alleged 200,000-plus Nigerians living in Houston, many of them Easterners. It's a globalized migrating world.
I said about Houston. I wonder what there is in Houston.
That's what I'm told.
That's where my language trainer's kids are in Nepal, too.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Inc. is oil and Nigerian oil. Company links.
If you reminisce, when the oil was found in our part of the eastern region, this Shell, BP, and others would build a little thing called a Christmas tree. It's a pipe with a lot of valves on and keep it shut. My recommendation was hide it. Don't tell anybody. Every country that discovers oil and gets on the world market, the rural people suffer from then on. Poverty increases. The wealth get wealthier and fewer. The rest get poorer and larger. And don't let it come here.
Nobody listened,
And they still don't.
Right. Well, and the disparities are such that recently some of the eastern Nigerians occupied one of the
administrative.
Well, we're on their side.
Right.
How much of the oil money has gone to roads, schools, health posts?
Right.
See, that's the whole problem in Nepal as well.
Could you say a word about the people who were the big figures in Michigan State's history that shaped this development period in the 60s and 70s that brought international studies to the university in a new way, and what would you associate with their contributions?
Well, of course, it's John Hanna.
Number one is John Hanna.
And what was
number two is John Hanna.
I see.
Number three is John Hanna. Then Glenn Taggart was a major figure. Now Glenn was working for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He had a PhD from Utah State, I think, where he did his undergraduate work. And he was in the Department of Agriculture. And John Hanna had seen him and asked him if he'd like to come to Michigan State and join our sociology faculty. And he was there working with, we had a a U.S. overseas thing. I used to know its name. It wasn't technical systems, but it was the international agriculture thing. They were working in Latin America on bananas and things like that, really basically for import to the United States. They're working on diseases of plants in many different countries. And also there's a plant quarantine and an animal quarantine kind of thing. And Glenn was head of that unit, having grown up in it over years. And he wouldn't bite on John Hanna's proposal. But then I think it was Eisenhower became president, and the Secretary of Agriculture, I used to be able to call his name, the gentleman from Utah.
Orville Freeman?
No, Benson.
Benson.
Anyway, somebody, a more junior official from the Secretary's office, came into Glenn Taggart's office and closed the door and said, "Glenn, we've decided to keep you." He said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you know, in the civil service structure, you're right at the level between the political appointees and the professionals, and we could just replace you with a political appointment, but you're doing so well, we want to keep you." The man left his office. Glenn picked up the phone and called John Hanna. He said, "You said something about joining your sociology department. I'm ready." And he came out here.
And roughly when was that?
Well, it's in our memory time. So
let's say Eisenhower was elected in 52, I think.
Yeah, and we were here in 53, 54. What we're saying is about 60 that I got involved with. So about the late 50s, maybe 57. Mm-hmm. And we could find that record.
No, that's fine.
Because it was the very same day, and then the next week, Glenn Taggart came out here and visited, and he started in the sociology department. And he worked some with the extension then. And in that department, of course, was also John Useem. And he was not in favor of the administrative structure ever, I think just in principle, no matter what it was. But he was a strong faculty voice in terms of the international. He was a anthropologist, sociologist. During the war, he was in the island of Palau as the U.S. military governor, or military whatever, and he was very much concerned with the American students have to learn more about the other cultures of the world. So that's two from over there.
Yeah, the
in political,
Glenn Taggart, Paul Miller, I think, is someone
else.
Yeah,
Paul Miller. Well, Paul Miller,
as you've mentioned before.
Yeah, was very much involved. He would be a good one to get an official, because Paul was in the sociology department. Then he came to Extension, became its director, and then we had a vice president started for overseas, not for for international. For off-campus, like if we had a vice president for off-campus things, Woody Varner was his name, and then we had a vice president for on-campus things, and then we had a president, and both of those I think went to other places, probably to other places to become the university president. And Hannah got the idea that we ought to have a provost, and he asked Paul Miller if he would be the provost. Different from most of our provosts since then, Paul Miller came over to this building, which was very new then, and he looked up the word provost. He got into the stacks and he looked on that educational administration, and he said, "What is a provost and what are they supposed to do?" And he spent a week here, I know, because I was his assistant and I had to cover the office for that week. And he did nothing but really study that. And then he started being a provost. And, you know, he used to have meetings in his office. He'd call in faculty members from all over. They'd sit on the carpet because there weren't that many chairs, and he would discuss issues of the content of courses, the kind of courses we ought to have, and what would be useful, what the university should become, and organization, reorganization when that came. Anyway, and he was very much involved in the international dimension, a good supporter of Glenn Taggart. Well, they'd been in the same department for a while. And but as provost, he had more clout in terms of the international things. And as we started the institutes and centers, he was a major figure.
And what was, how would you typify Hanna's and their vision of international at MSU?
That it was sort of like an immunization in biological terms. They had to inject something into the university, from the library, you know, to the extension system, to all the academic courses in between, to the research program, that had an international dimension, and not just that it used the word international. that whatever it was studying had to have a global perspective of that thing, whatever it was. And I think Hannah Taggart, Paul Miller, and a few others shared that as time went by. And some of the enemies of that, who, you know, that's not what we're here for. I am a whatever. An anthropologist couldn't do that. But somebody else could say, you know, I'm an entomologist. I study bugs. I don't care about these things.
And I'm here to help the farmers of Michigan.
Yeah. And, well, that's at least something, because they could just say, I'll stay in my lab with my collection and I'll teach students. And I don't care what the farmers of Michigan are doing. So it's sort of one step to do that. But if you do say you're a better entomologist, if you know what the farmers of Michigan are doing, then you're still a better entomologist. And, you know, we have the insects don't have to have passports or visas. They can go. When I later got in the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, that's one of the big things that they are involved with, because insects carry human diseases and insects themselves eat crops and whatnot, and they travel. They go with the wind and whatnot, and they are not a national or a regional thing. They are a global thing. You know, we've chosen one little piece. You can take out the word insect and put a lot of other things in it, big things like oil or small things like SARS or whatever that disease is, and there was a, you know, you can't in a nutshell, you can't be a top-notch professional in your field unless you have an international scope of your own thinking about it. And then that group and some others systematically tried to organize the centers and the institutes and work with the other deans.
And you know, a lot of it, this isn't a reflection on Hannah, you got to do that next week for somebody, but I can remember every year at the beginning of faculty, they would have beginning of the semester, they would have a faculty reception over at the Union, and President Hannah and Mrs. Hannah would have a receiving line. He would call you by name. Not only that, but George changed jobs almost every single year those first years, and he knew exactly what he was doing. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just very skilled.
Now, it was a much smaller institution. You can do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this, because he was tuned into what was going on. Now, he himself had worked in the State Department and in other kind of things in the U.S. government on and off over the years. But, yeah, you know, whether or not we should have a weed garden here near this building or not, the long-range planning for his policy was that whenever there's any land available south of the campus, buy it, no matter what it was. So for this mile and a half from, I can't remember the names of the roads.
Harrison to Hagedorn.
Harrison, yeah, from those two roads, Grand River was here. Anything that became available south, we'd buy it because we're going to need it. Well, he was saying that when we first got here, you know, and Farm Lane had a little bridge on it that you could walk across, and they widened it a little bit so you could drive across, and the dairy barn, you know, was an ag hall first, and then they moved to another location where the planetarium now is. But he was thinking way, way ahead. He was a long-range planner. And now Floyd Reeves is another name that Floyd Reeves was at Chicago in the College of Education, and he helped with the planning and evolution of the college, of the University of Chicago in many ways. Hannah met him in some of the collegiate meetings, and Hannah brought him here. And so he was a close advisor to Hannah on all kinds of things.
Chicago was very much involved in that period in the planning of undergraduate curriculum,
yes,
and math.
Yes.
And the general studies program.
General studies.
And Floyd Reeves was a major force in the evolution of Michigan State organization.
So the integrated studies, our general education program, got shaped by them.
And I'm trying to answer your question. Who are the names of individuals who come to mind? Those names are among them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
There are probably some others that I'm subliminally
Ag, I think of my names are not coming to me. The guy in plant science.
In plant pathology?
Harwood. You know his name?
Mm-hmm.
Harwood,
right.
The one who's been here recently,
He's recently, right.
Yeah.
He came from the organic farm.
Yes.
Right.
But he's much later than that. I mean,
well, but over international kind of influential people, I think he's been that since he's been here.
Are there any observations that you would make about the African studies effort in those early years? How the Nsukka project related to the academic? There's a group here that wasn't involved in that were in history.
Of course, one goal was to do more involvement, but I think many of the academics saw this as an intrusion. I mean, the whole idea of doing a technical assistance project, and I think, you know, in those days, as a good anthropologist, really, number one, it's wrong to try to change them, and number two, you're sending people there who don't know anything about it, and so I think they saw this really as a negative force, and as a really surfacey, not in-depth thing, which in a lot of ways it was. That, you know, if you want to go to an area to study, you should bring people who work in that field. But if most of them either won't go or will go, but they don't want you to change it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going as a change agent, you know, politically that may be, and that's how you're getting financed. And I think there was a major negative feeling, I would say, in the social sciences particularly, and in other places, that these international projects were a waste of time and money. We shouldn't get into them. And it became clear, if you don't have a thing like the African Studies Program, you see, then you don't have a base to do international technical assistance in Africa, and if you don't have a base, you're going to make all kinds of big mistakes. You look at the first group that was recruited, the first six or so, you know, they really, John Hansen was the only one. He was enough concerned with learning seriously, so he wanted to know what is the, you know, who needs to learn what and how and what are the procedures now and there. Well, you could take those questions to Alaska or anyplace else. He took them there, and he learned a lot about the country. Most of them just went to a place where it was very frustrating because these people don't understand. Well, to start with, these people don't understand. The truth is, you don't understand what these people know, and these people usually know more than you do about the things that are important to them. And it seems to me, in the 60s, here and in other parts of the international development career, that hadn't come through. It helped to have the dependency people concerning with the dependence-independence phenomenon and the fact that, well, there's so much of the dependency thing. And
it's like dependency theory coming out of Latin America.
Exactly. Because it seems to me that the serious scholars of these international inventions could see, really, that, oh, if you are doing whatever your academic field is in a different culture, in a different setting, in a different language, there's not much you can do. There may be a lot of things they can do, and you can work together somehow. And the idea of collaboration, which Nancy and I were writing about recently, just wasn't there. The assumption was, as I mentioned earlier, that the Americans sort of knew everything. They just won the war, you know, and they could win. And they could... same assumption that some of our government still has. And that... The academics who were good in their fields knew better, but they didn't want it. This was a dirty game being played. Now, you know, you mentioned Vietnam. I don't know much of the details of that, but I do know that MSU and political science have people who are studying public administration and village administration in Vietnam. Made some excellent publications, and what they learned about village administration in Vietnam was useful to us in dealing with village administration, not so much in Nigeria in those years, but in the other places we've been. And they don't even have public administration. For a while, they discovered that. When I was here in the early years, I remember taking a course in comparative public administration with one of those guys. We had a textbook that was comparing public administration. Where did it compare? England, France, and USA. Mm-hmm. And it showed how their structures were. Well, they began to get some people who realized, you know, it's not that way everywhere, but it helps to know the France part if you're going to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we had I'm sorry about scholarly productivity, and one of the things, now I'm just speculating, that got MSU involved in a technical assistance program, we were among the few who had scholars who had done legitimate scholarship in the villages of Vietnam, and we have publications, I think, in this building. You could find them about that. Now, all of these other accusations, It's a little bit like looking at the space shuttle that just came down, you know, and started to point your finger at which engineer. Now, nobody said that it was an MSU engineer who engineered the thing which made the foam fall out and hit the wing. If it did, we'd be having demonstrations on our campus. And, you know, yesterday, because I was here, I guess, for some of the demonstration period, our daughter was out on State Street demonstrating.
It's not State Street, that's Cornell.
Thank you. That's also
Wisconsin.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at Wisconsin man here. And we were in Illinois for that one year, uh-huh. And she called down and she said, I'm carrying a banner. And I said, what does your banner say? It says, Peace Now. So old George said, and what later? Well, she didn't want to talk to me anymore. She wanted to talk to her mother. But I think that era, the well-deserved criticism of our sort of blind, know-nothing interventions using our military and financial power was revealed to be blind. I'm trying to be kind. And I think academe in total learned a lot of lessons in that period. But today it's hard to find the demonstration of that except in discomfort. But another thing that I think academe learned is you've got to control the money. Whoever controls the money controls the curriculum. We don't talk about that in public, but it has a tremendous impact. And if whoever controls the money with our communication system also controls the vote, we got a big problem. You know, Nancy and I work with FAO and others in many countries now, usually working in a place where the rich are very, very rich, and this includes Nigeria, and the poor are very, very poor. And there's a distance between them that we're concerned about. If we could only make the poor fewer percentage-wise and the rich more but weak but weaker, and if there were more of the resources on the bottom and or less difference between the top and the bottom. Mm-hmm. And every time we come back to the USA, it's worse here. And it's a frustration.
And especially a frustration when you get so old, you know you can't escape. Mm-hmm. We're stuck here.
Right.
In this. I think we spent time on this.
Yeah. It's a very different era now from the period, as you're observing, from the era when you went to Nigeria, went to Nepal. Those were more optimistic periods.
Yes.
About global development, about Africa in general, and South Asia. They were, and the U.S. was seen as a benign presence in that, mm-hmm. at that time.
And not the aggressor.
Publicly.
Right.
But you know, from a Latin American perspective, for instance, and I'm not an expert there, but I was in Chile up to the week before Allende was shot. And I was working with the education ministry, and they urged me to get out as quickly as I can, which I did. Well, the American track record in Chile, in Colombia, in Argentina, in Nicaragua, in El Salvador, and you could go on.
And you could say as well with Idi Amin and General Mobutu, exactly. And the exile,
exactly.
In Mars.
Exactly.
And there's another
so,
story.
So, you know,
to be told
we don't want our history made very public.
Right.
And so do you want a good historian publishing on American intervention, even in Honduras, pretty safe, but probably if the university would get blamed if you tried to publish. So and that's sort of the real world of today.
Well, you were there in Nigeria in the Cold War period at the time that there was a strong emphasis with Soapy Williams, former governor of Michigan, as Kennedy's first Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, saying Africa for the Africans, and with a very positive message about development, and we want to support you. And indeed, one assumes that USAID's support of the University of Nigeria project was out of that, winning friends and influencing people and doing good for development.
Sure.
Kind of rationale of the Kennedy administration, and was not very much involved with the other attempting to put down Nkrumah and to bring up Mobutu as a Cold War.
Except you had this phenomenon of the assumption that Americans knew the answers, you know, even in the things that we're trying to do in Insuko, when we really didn't know even what the questions were. So in a benevolent way, with Sophie Williams and the president then wanting to, you know, let's give them, let's be our Lady Bountiful and give them our mm-hmm. wealth of knowledge. But
right.
if our knowledge was obsolete and irrelevant, then giving bigger packages of it is not exactly producing much.
But there were Nigerians like Nnamdi Azikiwe who wanted those.
I was about to say that.
That's exactly what they wanted.
Exactly, because Zeke and people like that had been in the United States and gotten their education here. But they saw that there was a difference between this and the classic British mm-hmm. system. And yet he was smart enough to know that it should be not this and not that, but something that was their own.
So based on these years with Michigan State, with USAID, with MUSEA, with in Nepal and across Africa in a number of places, where do you think the U.S. should stand on the issues of development in the third world, if we can use those old terms? What is the where should we be going as a country and with the pressing and growing needs of the poor of the world?
Number one, are you saying Michigan State or the USA?
Well, let's start with the U.S., and let's come down to Michigan
State.
The
U.S. should work more through the United Nations system and less by itself. That's my number one. Nancy, you got a number two?
Could there be more development assistance and more funding?
There should be more, but to use the word assistance, it seems to me that's a little bit obsolete. When we had the assumption that we had it all, we could assist others. But Nancy and I right now about collaboration. If I want to help you and do something that's going to really benefit you, we have to be collaborators. You have to have veto power. You have to know the situation. You have to really guide it. And if I got anything to offer, well, we got to both bring something to the table. If I don't need what you have and you don't need what I have, we're never going to collaborate. And it seems to me that a collaborative approach to international, what we used to call technical assistance, is much more appropriate now than it may have been then. And it has a chance. And the collaborative probably doesn't mean international. It means a global, and in the sense that the UN system is there. They have people in it that know better how to do these things than the people in our own governments.
You might say that our education system from day one of first grade should be teaching people to collaborate, which is a skill that we aren't known for, and certainly not in the present political system known for.
But you went with a more collaborative period to Nigeria and planned to collaborate at
yes.
the invitation
yeah.
of
Nigerians,
really right?
They had the most money. We had a few people. Most of the funds were there.
The Nigeria was an early example, kind of isolated, really, of collaboration.
Well, if you want to take a look at these faculty members from MSU who came there, quite a few, 15 per year, for a period of 6-7 years, those who were able and willing to collaborate with their counterparts learned more and were more successful. Mm-hmm. Those who came to teach their counterparts what they ought to know tended to be very frustrated and have all kinds of other mm-hmm. psychological problems and come home disappointed, annoyed, and whatnot, because they knew they were failing, but they didn't know why.
And if I could excuse jumping from that continent to another, the 2 years in Nepal in the rural village are exceedingly disappointing to me in the sense that they haven't become what we thought they might be. And that, I think, is because, in a sense, the Nepalese were not ready for collaboration. Thank you. They weren't trained for collaboration. I mean, they didn't have collaborative skills, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So they really didn't. They were, because of all kinds of things that are there, and because we have worked there for over 15 years now, and I know it better than I ever got to know the Nigerians in that sense, I suppose.
Yeah.
They aren't to the point where collaboration is possible for them.
And I think neither
will
we.
They don't get there.
Neither were we. You know, because we worked in Nepal a long time. There was that first 2 years, then there was another three-year assignment. We've been working back and forth a lot. In my second three-year assignment, it was in the capital city, and my Nepali, I got a Nepali language teacher again to bring me up to date on that. He said, you know, you're talking Bush Nepali. You got to have Mantralani. Right? You can be working with the ministers of all the government agencies. You got to talk a different level, a more Sanskritized kind of Nepali. And in my process of doing that, I was trying to learn to read in that script. And I could read the newspapers, but they were too fancy, too. I couldn't get anywhere in the newspapers. But children's books were very good for me. And some of the same fairy tales that you would have a three-year-old working on, with a little bit of change. You know, it's not a goose laying a golden egg, it's a chicken laying a golden egg, and things like that. Very good. And then I got... In the Hindu religion, there is a publication, an ancient book now called the Swastani Katha, and that has like 12 chapters in it. And on a certain holiday each year, for a month, the family meets every day after their evening meal, and the youngest person who can read reads parts of that chapter, and then the whole month they're supposed to complete the chapter. So with my language teacher, I got started, and I tried to read, I can't remember what, Mag, I think, I was going to try to read enough out loud with his help and translate as I went that chapter in that month, because the youngest kid can do that. And I didn't really finish with that, but I learned so much more about Hindu culture. And then I said, gee, how did I ever go to that village, or to Rampur in that village, and know so little about it, and work with the Ministry of Education and help them make national education system plans and all kinds of things like that, when I was so damn ignorant about the nature of the underlying cultural phenomena. And then it's a Hindu and a Buddhist country, and they're both mixed. And later on, when I got to India to work again for FAO, I found that really modified my approach to working with them, because I had much more feeling for the Hindu and Buddhist perceptions of life and the world. Mm-hmm. And
I think, so what I'm really saying is in Nigeria, I think they were more ready for collaboration than we were capable of.
Well, they thought that these white Americans knew and could really solve their problems. Mm-hmm. And so did we. That innocence made a nice binding. But I think over time it became evident that we didn't really... Well, like I was giving you this corn planting example. You know, this guy is supposed to know about agronomy, doesn't even realize that we don't have a one-level agriculture. We got a three-level agriculture. And it doesn't work, these things you're telling us about.
I have to say to you that I am the oldest one here. And I'm feeling it, so I think we've been here long enough.
All right. Let me ask one last question, if I may, Nancy, just to stretch you here. And that is, we talked about where should the U.S. be in collaboration events. You've answered that. What should Michigan State's role in this new period be, given the Internet, given the change of the shape of the world, given all the shifts that you've been a part of in years, what do you see as important next steps or commitments of the university, or change of organization, or change of focus?
We're still being taped for this.
Yes.
Go ahead. You signed it.
Yes, go ahead. Well, I find our visit back here on the campus after being away as much as we have been, to be amazing to me that everybody I've talked to, and I obviously talked to only certain people, but I didn't mean to, but they're all so discouraged by our political national situation that I don't see where we're going.
You're saying that it stultifies or it provides barriers from our international, for our international work and for international
I would
studies
think so.
And so on.
Yeah, I would think so.
And you know, in a sense, you know, we're doing a good thing. We're lending our president to an important international task. But I'm saying, you know, this is the 1940s model. and it didn't work then, even more dangerously, it's not going to work now. And there are some things, you know, to use the medical kind of example, there are some things you can't do for them. If you want a patient and you're the doctor to eat less sugar, you can tell him, you can urge him, you can pride him, you can bribe him, but he can still do what he wants to do. And so we're getting a very good lesson in the Middle East now. And but you don't see these collaborative kind of things happening, you know. And even in our relations with Europe, when your top leadership insults everybody they can insult, and then you wonder why they don't love you. Yeah, and she's saying,
okay.
Okay. You think I would be saying?
It's been a pleasure, and we've certainly appreciated a chance to hear your question.
Well, thank you very, very much for this. Let me just say, for the record, in this historical record here, that you were listing the people who made a difference in the shape of this university's international studies and its projects and programs, and we would put the two of you at the top of that list as well, with Hannah and those others who shaped much of the way that we do international studies and programs at Michigan State in all sorts of ways. And if, you know, I would say we look with pride at the way that Michigan State graduate students are now doing in national competitions and so on. And clearly you folks established the foundations, the shape of the engagement abroad that has made that possible. So
Michigan State did all of that and more for us. We have been changed and changed and then in a modest way, maybe improved by Michigan State for 51 years now.
How do you turn two old professors off?
Okay, we just have. Okay, thank you very much again for spending this time with us.